Hi, everybody. We're live. I changed up the band this time. I played some Goose this time.
Oh, God. Oh.
So different.
Oh, I don't know if I like this at all. Because even though I'm in full support of you broadening your horizons, which to your credit, you actually have done. But I'm not. So here's the thing. I'm not an athlete. I've never been an athlete. Anyone who has met me in person will not find this surprising at all.
I ask myself, where is this going?
Yeah, right.
But as it so happens, I've been rewatching The Last Dance recently, which is a just phenomenal documentary series chronicling the Chicago Bulls double three-peat.
Still have no idea.
And yep.
Unless you're
going to
do the bus on the Chicago Bridge.
No.
The Dave Matthews
I mean, I'm just, we're following you on this journey, Casey.
We're required to mention the poop bus every time we mention any kind of band on this show.
Yes, I know. In any case, something that athletes seem to do is wear like the same garments, or tie their shoes in the same way, or, left shoe, then right shoe. You know, there's all these superstitions. And now I feel like if we have a truly terrible recording, or I don't know, maybe if I spill something on my computer, not that that would ever happen, perhaps it's because you chose to break the mold and not play Fish before the show for the live listeners. And so I am absolving myself. I am preemptively absolving myself of any guilt if anything bad happens this episode. It's all because you broke tradition.
This is really a real insight into the way Casey's mind works. So what he wanted to say was like, you broke with tradition and it's like a superstition, kind of like the sports superstition. But he started with, I'm not an athlete. Then he mentioned a movie he liked about sports. Then he got to people in sports do superstitious things. And then finally...
Gosh, I really am realizing my full potential as Alex Cox, aren't I?
It connected. Everything connected. It's just it was a long path, and that's an insight into how your mind works, because that was your path to that thought. My only thought was I was trying to come up with a fish goose joke, and I didn't know if you would get that reference. Oh, you get that one, but you don't get duck season, rabbit season. That one goes over both of your heads.
No, that's Bugs Bunny.
Why didn't you get it before then?
When did you say it before?
Oh, maybe probably... you didn't hear when. Well, no, you heard us. We couldn't hear you. Marco was talking about the ducks out his window, and he said he's not sure if it's duck season. And I said maybe it's rabbit season. And Marco took it straight up and said, no, the rabbits don't come out yet or something. I'm like,
it's full of rabbits. I have tons of rabbits, but I also did, yes, indeed, miss the joke.
Okay, all right. It's not a joke, just a reference. But Casey got it, so I'm declaring partial victory.
Thank you. I think that was during the time I was realizing, they're not ignoring me. They can't hear me.
What was the problem? You just didn't have your mic connected or what?
No, it was set to the system audio, which was, you should have heard.
Right, as we normally do when you're on the wrong mic.
Exactly.
As soon as we didn't yell at you that you're on the wrong mic, you should have known that wasn't.
That's also fair. That's a good point. I guess because I was just very, very quiet. But you know why? Because I'm hunting wabbits.
He doesn't get that either.
I mean, I've seen those old cartoons 1,000 years ago when they, were made, and I was
didn't make an impression.
Yeah. All right, let's get the show on the road. We have a lot of follow up because we're still in the WWDC follow up season. And friend of the show, Ricky Mondello, wrote with regard to iCloud Keychain browser integration in Sequoia. So we had talked last episode. I think it was last episode. It was 592, whatever one we're on now. And we had talked about how there were some kind of unusual JSON files stored on the file system, and we weren't really sure what it was about. And it didn't seem bad, but it didn't seem entirely right either. And Ricky has worked on a lot of the passwords-related stuff for Apple for a long time. I was lucky enough to see Ricky at WWDC. I don't think either of you were with me at the time, but they are doing great, and I was very happy to see them. Anyways, coming back to the point here, I'm going off on a tangent again. Gosh, I'm so Alex this episode. Anyway, so Ricky writes, ATP episode 592 speculated that macOS Sequoia pre-installs the iCloud Passwords browser extension for Chrome users. It absolutely does not. The discussed JSON files support the user installable extension communicating with the OS to securely access password data. See, a link we'll put in the show notes. The new Passwords app does encourage Chrome and Edge users to install the extension on first launch, however. The button opens the browser to the button that they, they're using to promote this opens the browser to the relevant Chrome or Edge web store page. All right, good talk. That's
cool.
The next item is more detail on the same.
All right,
topic.
Good deal. So Simeon writes, I'm a DevRel engineer for Firefox add-ons and previously Chrome extensions. The JSON file you mentioned is part of Chrome's quote-unquote native messaging. system. As the name suggests, this allows extensions to and native applications to exchange messages. More specifically, this files how a desktop application tells Chrome that if its partner extension is installed, Chrome can route the messages between them. In order for this to work, both sides have to know about each other and opt into communication over a native messaging port. Also, while browsers used to allow other applications to directly sideload extensions, they've scaled back that functionality for security, privacy, and annoyance reasons. Today, browsers let native apps notify the user that an extension is available for installation, but don't actually install it until the user opts in. And there's a couple of more informative links that we will also put in the show notes.
Yeah, so that explains it. The last episode, we were talking about how the path in the JSON file was to one of those system cryptexes or whatever, but apparently that's to the thing that mediates between, I'm assuming it's a thing that mediates between them, the native messaging system thing. So these are just sort of declaring, hey, if an app, if these Chrome extensions or Firefox extensions with these signatures appear, allow them to communicate through this mediated extension to, you know, get and set password data. So the actual extensions are not part of Sequoia.
All right, Milian, I'm sorry, I don't remember how to pronounce their name properly, but who's doing incredible work over at Mac Stories, reminds us that network location support is already in macOS 14 Sonoma. Whoopsie-doopsies, I did not realize.
That was my Casey-less moment, because I think we talked about this on the show, and I can't expect either one of you to remember, but I should
have
remembered.
No, of course not.
Whenever it came back, it was probably in a follow-up item, and I just totally forgot about it. I don't even know if it came back in Sonoma. It might have come back in the OS before that, which, of course, we all know the name of.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Let's not do that. Let's not do that, please.
Big Island? God.
I'm not even going to wager a guess because it's going to be embarrassing. So I'm just going
to
plow forward. All right. With regard, that's it. For a split second, I thought you were serious. So with regard to iPhone mirroring, we had thought that, hey, maybe what you can do is in Sonoma. Nope, not Sonoma. Yes. No. What's the new one? God bless
Sequoia.
Sequoia. You can't use two S names in a row, Apple. Come on. I'm
Mac OS 18. Okay.
Yeah. The one before was Centura.
Yep.
Anyways, in Sequoia, in beta 2, Hunt 2013 writes that you cannot enter home screen edit mode while using iPhone mirroring. So the plague of jiggle mode lives on.
Last night, I had Merlin test this, and he also could not figure out how to get into wiggle mode because apparently, like, the phone is locked when you're doing the mirroring thing or whatever. So he couldn't. I was like, I'll just hold down on the icon on the phone. He was telling me he couldn't, like, make it. The icons wiggle that way, and apparently holding down with the mouse cursor on the mirrored thing on your Mac also doesn't put it into wiggle mode. So I maybe this is not definitive. Maybe it's just a limitation of the beta, but man, why would they do that? Why would they make it so you couldn't enter wiggle mode on your home screen?
Yeah, I'm not sure what that's about. I don't know. Maybe I was going to say maybe it's too much motion and
frame rate, but it's right next to the, like, they do sidecar with the iPad with a much bigger screen. So
right.
It doesn't make any sense. It could just be a bug. We'll find out. The reason I haven't tried this is because I was all ready to try it. Oh, it's in beta 2 of Sequoia. I have beta 2 of Sequoia installed on a real drive and also in a VM, although apparently VMs can't do it because of some Bluetooth limitation. But anyway, then I realized, oh, you also need the beta on your phone. I was like, well, I'm not ready to do that yet. So I haven't been able to try this, but whichever one of us first installs the beta of Sequoia and the beta on their phone, we'll see if we can figure it out.
Not it on that one. With regard to HomePod RAM, I think this was in the context of, does it have enough RAM to do Apple Intelligence stuff? I think.
Yes.
Jan Gobble writes, according to Every Mac, the HomePod 2 has an S7 chip with 1 gig of RAM, and the HomePod Mini an S5 with 1 gig of RAM. Seeming a little slim. I don't think that's going to work.
Probably not going to be running any on-device Apple Intelligence with that amount of RAM.
Mm-hmm. We had somebody writing in anonymously with regard to tvOS's Insight feature. This is the a clone of Amazon X-Ray. I run metadata APIs for one of the largest media companies on the planet. I don't know exactly how Amazon or Apple tags metadata, but I can offer some insight into how we do it. We process hundreds of hours of content every week, and it's all tagged scene by scene with actors' locations, music, attitudes, moods, DEI info, and more. This is done with a mix of ML and a team of about 50 human taggers, and it is all done before content distribution. ML does the first pass, and then the humans are tasked with checking the machine, as well as adding contextual mood-based tags that the machine doesn't or can't understand. The first pass is relatively fast, and our accuracy is over 98%. This is achieved by having relatively limited data sets with specialized dynamically generated ML models for each show or movie. For example, if the ML is tagging one of our sitcoms, the first thing it does is call for a list of actors and locations that have been previously tagged. It then dynamically, quote unquote, trains a small specialized model using only that data. This operation only takes a few seconds. Then the robot matches existing tags to faces and places them from within the custom model. If any faces are new to the model at the end of the tagging algorithms, then generalized ML facial and location matches are made and flagged as needing a human tagger approval. This tagging is much faster, more accurate than either human taggers or any generalized facial recognition ML, and can be automated on large batches of back library content without massive computing overhead.
That's a great example of just machine learning really taking a huge chunk out of that workload, because if it was done completely manually by humans, just what a slog, not a particularly fun job, slow. And the point that like the ML can, you know, potentially beat humans on a first pass just because it's so tedious. The work is so tedious that like, you know, the computer is, you know, as good as it is, but it never gets tired, right? So whatever it's doing in the first hour, it's also going to do in the 900th hour, whereas the humans are going to fade. So this is an interesting human-computer combination to do all this. And I love that they're tagging it based on not just like who's in the scene, but like the mood of the scene and stuff. It's, you know, interesting that they're throwing so much metadata at whatever company this person works for, which they didn't say in their message. But yeah, I'm all for this. Metadata is great. The more, the better.
Yeah. Mihai Parparita writes with regard to chess on macOS that based on infinitemac.org, the chess app first showed up in NextStep 1.0 as a developer sample app. So that means, kids, it's almost 35 years old. Holy
shit. That's a fun thing of Infinite Mac, which for people don't know, it's a way to sort of run in your web browser really old versions of macOS and now also old versions of Next. And so to answer this question that I was musing about last time, I wonder how old chess is. I said, I thought it was dated back to the Next days, but I didn't know how far. Well, you could try to look that up on the Wikipedia page, try to find someone a blog post about chess in the Next app, but like it's so much more direct to just go to infinitemac.org and pick an OS and launch it, like pick Next app in some version and launch it and see if the chess app is there, and then just go back in time and go older and older until you don't see it anymore. I love Infinite Mac. Whoever did that site is amazing.
Indeed. With regard to CarPlay, where did we leave our intrepid heroes last episode? I feel I can't recall specifically because it was a while ago and I've been busy, which we'll talk about in the after show.
I believe we left them as next generation CarPlay has been announced and yet nothing has it, which is where we've left it for the last
years?
So 3 years.
Let me help you here. So we had an item about it. There was some feedback from someone who'd watched the next generation CarPlay sessions at WWDC and was characterizing them as a bunch of Apple developers. Saying, here, you look at all these variations you can have. You can pick any variation of this one font, for example, and that kind of attitude was not going to mesh well with the car maker's desire to have much more control over the appearance of their cars. But many questions remained about next-gen CarPlay because at that point, none of us had seen the sessions. Well, now I have seen all the sessions that are relevant to this, and so now we actually have some information to share.
Yeah, so I 2x them earlier today, so you probably digested them far better than I did, but I was just trying to, you know, mainline them basically before we recorded. There were a couple of interesting parts, and you actually called out in the show notes for the three of us something that I was going to call out when I was watching it, a quote from the first session, which is entitled Next Generation CarPlay Design System. And a quote from the host, they had said, it enables you to express your own visual design philosophy within CarPlay to create an iconic individual look tailored to you, your vehicles, and their unique functions. The result won't just look like Apple, and it also won't just look like a copy of the built-in system. It's designed to be a unique celebration of both brands, a special co-branded experience only when your vehicle and iPhone come together. And it reflects a great deal of hard work we've done with automakers all over the world to innovate the in-car experience. Our design system for automakers, this is a little bit later, empowers you in partnership with our team here at Apple to develop a beautiful co-branded experience that celebrates both brands.
Right, so this answers a lot of questions. So first of all, the question we were always asking, next-gen CarPlay, it takes over all the screens. A few shows ago, we had some quotes from interviews with the Mercedes and Polestar CEO on Decoder podcast with the host asking, would you let Apple take over all your screens? And one of them was like, no way, we're not letting Apple take over all our screens. The other one was like, oh, they can take over the screens because we still run the car and it's not a big deal. But we still had this question, like, what does this mean? How does the car work when the phone's not there? Is the phone required? Does this stuff run on the car? Does it run on the phone? Is it a combination? This and then also the feedback we had last time about, you know, oh, you can pick one font, it's got to look like Apple or whatever. This clearly gives a bunch of answers. Number one, there is a built-in system. If you don't have an iPhone and you get in the car, all the screens are filled with something, something made by the car maker, right? So that is clear. Number two, the way Apple sees this is that this next-gen CarPlay experience is supposed to be a blending of Apple's branding and your car's branding. It's like, okay, your car is your car and whatever your car looks like and all the screens and everything. But when you get in with your iPhone, what we want is to say, now iPhone-ify this car. What does this car look like when I come in with my iPhone? Woo, my iPhone takes over everything and it's iPhone branded, but it's also your branded, but it's Apple branded, but it's your brand. They're so clear that they're saying, we're not giving you a system where you, car maker, can make it look like how you want to promote your brand. That is not even what Apple is offering. Forget about whether they deliver. They're not saying, hey, we gave you a system and you can make this look like Audi. Whatever you want Audi to look like, we give you the flexibility. No, they're not even offering that. They're saying, we will give you the ability to make a look that is a combination that celebrates both brands. It's a combination of Apple's aesthetic and yours. And you can debate how much of a balance, like where is that line? How much is it? Is it 50% Apple, 50% Audi? Or is it 60-40? Or is it 90-10? Or whatever. But that is the pitch, that this is what your car looks like when it's painted with a giant iPhone paintbrush. And it only happens when someone enters with a phone. And when they don't do that or don't connect their car to your, their phone to your car, it just looks like your car. So I found this very surprising because I assume next-gen CarPlay took over all the screens. It would be some kind of thing of like, look, you know, it'll be a CarPlay-like experience, but, you know, Apple's offering you the technology to do all your screens, right? And you can customize it and so on and so forth and integrate with CarPlay. But I thought that would be like the whole thing. And then there would be a carve-out for when your phone's there, but when your phone's not there, it would still look like that. But that's not it at all. And it makes me think even more like, who would want this? Who would want to have to design every screen in their car? You know, they have to design every screen in their car. They spend all this time to make everything look nice. They integrate all the features. And then Apple's saying, we would like it when someone gets into your car with an iPhone for that phone to cover up everything you've done. Right. And by the way, you have to do work to integrate this. And we'll get to that in a little bit of how the integration works. Every pixel that you've done before, we want to potentially cover up. Oh, there's places where your stuff can peek through and we'll talk about that. But like, because that would be a co-branded experience that blends the best of Apple in your car. And the car maker would be like, why would I want to blend the best of Apple into my car? Like, why do I want to do that? Because people who own iPhones love iPhones so much. They want every screen they look at to look like an iPhone and be branded like an Apple thing. Boggles my mind, but at least question answered. That's what next gen CarPlay is, and now it is no longer, it is even less surprising that there have not been car makers jumping on this.
I will say there's one aspect of it that I saw just breeze by in some slide somewhere, that it's one of the changes in next gen CarPlay is quote buffered audio. This sounds a lot like AirPlay 2 and the way that approaches audio buffering, which is, so, you know, AirPlay 1 had, in order to address, you know, the realities of, like, dropouts and interference and stuff, so that your music wouldn't have, like, little skips and static, it introduces a buffer. AirPlay 1 had a fixed 2-second buffer on almost everything.
It's anti-shock all over again.
Yeah, exactly. It made it very sluggish to respond to, like, play-pause commands and stuff like that. And then AirPlay 2 basically introduced a system where the app could send a whole bunch of data all at once of, like, a minute or a minute and a half of audio to the client device and have the client device play it, you know, in a little bit more smart way, where operations like play-pause and seek would generally be able to use the buffer and kind of respond immediately. So that's one of the reasons why AirPlay 2 is so much better than AirPlay 1, and that just required, you know, more technical sophistication of, like, being able to transmit a whole bunch of data at once and have the client actually store a large buffer of it and be able to navigate it a little bit more smartly. Well, it sounds like that might be what they're doing with this CarPlay audio too, where, like, in the current version of CarPlay, the audio just goes over what I believe is Bluetooth I think all of the time, because it has, it creates like a little peer-to-peer Wi-Fi network for wireless CarPlay for the video streaming. I don't think the audio goes over that channel. I think the audio always is Bluetooth, but I could be wrong about that. But anyway, introducing, quote, buffered audio in this next-gen CarPlay sounds like the audio won't go over Bluetooth anymore, which will give them so much more control over latency and various handling details of that connection. So, honestly, I kind of wish they wouldn't tie these two things together. I wish they could find a way to introduce this new audio situation to a version of CarPlay that automakers are more likely to actually adopt. And maybe they will over time. But
it's not clear whether... So this is the next-gen CarPlay, and we'll talk about the architecture in a second, but it's not clear whether they demand that to get next-gen CarPlay, you have to let us take over all the screens, or whether a car maker could choose to implement next-gen CarPlay only on, like, the center screen. You know what I mean?
Oh, that's interesting.
Those type of business things were not mentioned in the WWDC. It's kind of a weird WWDC session, too, because I guess the audience is people who work for car makers. It's not like we, as just regular developers, can do anything with, like... Well, I guess your apps would run an extra CarPlay, but I don't think that experience has changed too much. But, like, they didn't... If they're really talking to the people who work at car makers, the business people will have a lot more questions. Like, you know, can we get, like, the better audio without letting you take over the instrument cluster, for example? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, at the beginning of the first session about the design system, I wasn't quick enough to call up the transcript, but the host says something along the lines of, this is for automakers. Or people who are just interested in design or cars or whatever, you know, and so that, and that's where we come in. One of the things that I did think was interesting was before I watched these videos, a lot of people were getting really perturbed that the San Francisco font family is the only font family allowed, which at first I was like, yeah, that stinks. But after watching the video, I see that there, while that is a little bit crummy, I actually am not that bothered by it because there's so many different variations between weight and kerning.
They all look like San Francisco, though. Like car makers have their own like fonts that evoke the car maker's brand. Some of them are, I think, kind of gaudy and ugly, but they look nothing like San Francisco. Like, again, because this is a co-branded experience. It celebrates both brands, but it only celebrates Apple in terms of the fonts. It's not does not celebrate, you know, BMW or Lamborghini or Ferrari in terms of the fonts. But, you know, it's a good... San Francisco's an amazing font. It looks great, but it always looks Apple. And so, like, again, what is the balance between it celebrates both brands? How much does it celebrate Apple versus how much does it celebrate your brand? And I feel like it's heavily weighted towards Apple because some things are not changeable. So the font family is one limitation. There's a limited number of gauge types. So, especially with all-screen instrument clusters, there's a lot of variation in gauge design. Most cars have three or four different variations, like little bar charts, a racing one, a regular looking one. Next-gen CarPlay has a wide variety, but not as wide as the actual world of existing cars. Another thing, a quote from the presentation, in our system, the speedometer is always paired with a fuel gauge or a state of charge gauge. That's fine, like you're going to have those things, but they're not always paired. Sometimes in existing cars on their instrument cluster, the speedometer is in a different place than the fuel gauge or the state of charge gauge, right? But in Apple's thing, they're always paired. Limitations like that are probably going to annoy car makers because they won't be able to do exactly what they want. But the architecture is actually really interesting. It is as complicated as you would imagine, which is also why it is difficult to adopt. There's basically four layers that are stuck together by two different compositors to, for example, form the instrument cluster. So the top one is the overlay UI, which has things like the tire pressure warning light and a bunch of other, like, what are they called? Telltales or indicators or, as my daughter calls them, emojis. She says, how's the gas in the car? I text her after she arrives at a destination because I never text her when she's on the road. She said it's fine. It's not even close to the gas emoji thing, or I don't even know. That's she's racist. Like she calls them all emojis, but anyway, kids these days. Then the next layer is the punch through UI, which is the built in system of the car can basically render whatever it wants on a region that it punches through. So lots of times the like like the driver assistance thing where they show like a 3D model of your car going down the road with the other cars that it's sensing around it. That is all built into the car. You're not going to redo that in CarPlay. You just punch that through. Like, you pick a region of the instrument cluster and it says, okay, car, you get to display what's here. Then there's the local UI, which is the like the gauges and everything. And then there's the remote UI, which is remote. All of the old CarPlay, it was all remote UI rendered by the phone and displayed. And so the remote UI, local UI, and punch through are composited together. And then the overlay UI is handled by the vehicle and composited together with those things. So the remote UI is rendered by the phone, exactly like it is in the previous generation of CarPlay. The overlay UI is rendered by the vehicle, and that includes the telltales and all the turn signals, the headlight indicator, stuff like that. The local UI, this is what I have to say about that. Local UI is not affected by Wi-Fi interference or disconnect since data stays local to the vehicle. The next generation of CarPlay starts instantaneously if you were using it on your previous drive. As soon as the displays are lit, or maybe when the door opens, or maybe when the driver is approaching the car, content is ready to show. This may even be before the iPhone has been detected or reconnected. So obviously this is not running on the phone. It is rendered locally by the vehicle. They use an OpenGL-based renderer. Hey, Apple's discovered OpenGL again. Why? Because car makers use it, and they got to deal with it. It includes image assets, behavior scripts, and it's specific to each vehicle and is transferred during the pairing process, and it can be refreshed over time. So basically, Apple has to provide a wad of stuff, code, assets, and everything, that go into the car that the car takes in, stores, and runs, because these screens need to come on instantly. So all that local UI, which includes like the speedometer, all those gauge things, all that stuff, it's rendered by the vehicle. Your phone hasn't even been detected, right? So there is an aspect of this next-gen CarPlay that is in the car, but it is shoved there by the phone and updated by the phone as needed and so on and so forth, right? And then the punch-through UI is entirely rendered by the vehicle. Another example is like the backup camera, right? That's just entirely rendered by the vehicle. It's just punched through the wherever they're going to display it. And they also mentioned like visually rich features are settings. So, you know, in like Mercedes or BMW, they show like this beautifully rendered picture of your seat with the little wavy lines with the heat and the massage and all that. You don't have to re-implement that. They're like, oh, just punch that through, right? But the punch-through UI is such a weird compromise because if you know what any of those screens look like on a fancy modern car, especially the ones that are like about, you know, adjust where the vents are pointing with the touchscreen or turn on the massaging function or like let's see the outside of the car and show all the doors opening when they open, all that stuff, right? It does not and will not match Apple's aesthetic. So they're like, okay, just carve out a box on any of the screens that Apple is rendering and show a totally incongruous, totally unmatching, fonts aren't the same, colors aren't the same, design isn't the same, just so you don't have to re-implement that. This is Apple saying, we are not going to make you re-implement literally every screen to be, you know, CarPlay-y and look like, but you can just punch through your existing UI, which makes us even less attractive because that's not a combination of the two brands. That's just the built-in system and Apple system in a patchwork, in an ugly quilt, because like I look at these Apple screens and I'm like, I've seen the screens in many, many different modern cars. None of them match this. Right? Yeah. Like, you don't want to have to redo that big settings screen. Just punch it through. It will look totally incongruous with everything else we render, but at least you don't have to re-implement it. This is quite an uphill struggle for next-gen CarPlay. And honestly, I don't even know like what's like. Why do this? What's the goal? Like, does Apple really want to be able to co-brand the instrument cluster? Why not just be satisfied having, to Marco's point, better and better integration with the screen that people want to see their car stuff on? Better audio, better lower latency video, more rich features. Instead of saying, we want to take over every pixel of every screen except for the part where you punch through your existing UI that's going to look nothing like ours.
You know, this makes me think of... Let's go on another journey, fellas. This makes me think of like Microsoft Teams and Slack, right? Like Android Automotive, I think that's the right one. Whatever it is, it's like the base layer, not Android Automotive,
I think.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Android Automotive is like, you know, Microsoft 365, right? We'll take care of it all for you. We've got this. You just sit back. You worry about the car stuff. We've got the infotainment stuff. And it's all taken care of. Easy peasy. And then Apple says, no, we need to basically duplicate all of your existing efforts and we need to do it together holding hands. Like I as a consumer, I think I would really enjoy this. I think it would be really nice and I think I would like it. But as a car manufacturer, this juice ain't worth the squeeze.
I don't think I would like it as a consumer. If I buy a car, like I buy a Polestar, and they have Polestar branded infotainment that matches the car, matches the Polestar brand, it fits in with the car, all the pictures on the screens reflect what's in the car, like it is a complete cohesive branded experience they pay a lot of people to do. When I get in that car with my phone, I don't want to cover over all that Polestar stuff and make the car iPhone-y, right? I like the iPhone. It's iPhone branded, but I don't want the rooms and vehicles that I enter to suddenly become iPhone branded. Like, I bought the car because I like the car's brand. I don't know why you would allow someone. If I enter a home, with my iPhone, your television's UI is going to be covered up with my iPhone UI because I've entered it now and I have my iPhone. Like, I don't want that. It doesn't match the car. Like, you can't change the design of the dashboard or the upholstery on the seats or the way the car looks. Why would I want to change everything that's on all the screens? It just, like, the reason people like phone integration is because they like, the phones are platforms and there are great apps for them and we have our life on them and all our songs are on them. And like, yeah, we want that integration. So stuff from our phone, we have a way to interact with it on the car, even so far as being able to use our voice assistants on our phone through the car. Like, that's great. Like, leverage the strengths of the phone. But the phone has nothing to do with the instrument cluster, as far as I'm concerned, other than, again, maybe showing navigation in there or something like that. Like, I don't want my car to be phone branded when I enter with my phone. And I would be annoyed if that was the only choice, because I would want to use CarPlay for the things that we all like CarPlay for. I would be saying, could I get that without you covering over my instrument cluster, the instrument cluster that I liked, with an iPhone UI that I don't particularly like and also have no control over? Because, yeah, the automakers can customize this and pick stuff, but it's not like the user gets to design their own instrument cluster with this. They have the same limited options that probably even more limited options than the built-in systems offer. Because, again, built-in systems usually offer two or three different instrument clusters on these fancy cars, and you could pick which one you like.
Yeah, I think I like CarPlay. I mean, I obviously don't usually have it in the Rivian, but I like CarPlay the way it is now, mostly in a window. Like, in some cases, CarPlay is the entire display of certain displays, but most car makers will let CarPlay take up most of the display when you're using it, but then will have some kind of like little area off to the side or below it or something that has like their toolbar buttons that'll switch you back over to their interface, and you still have to use their interface for most of the controls of the car. And then you switch back to CarPlay when you want to look at, your music player or your navigation. CarPlay already also has support for the secondary display. So if you want to have something like, for instance, if you're doing navigation and you want to have a CarPlay display in the dashboard cluster during navigation, you can already do that with the existing version of CarPlay, the old version. That was like a 1.5 that added that. So CarPlay, the way it is now, display-wise and integration-wise, already offers what I think I actually want as a customer. Like, I want CarPlay to be contained. I don't want it to take over everything because, like John was saying, like, I actually like car controls when they are well-designed. I like car UIs when they are well-designed. That is not the common case, but it does happen. And I just want more automakers to adopt CarPlay the way it is. And I hope, because a lot of these technological details and implementation details, like stuff like more stuff running on the car, the audio being buffered differently, not using Bluetooth, stuff like that, a lot of those things would actually be great improvements to the system we already have. And again, I hope that by Apple trying to reach much further design-wise, I hope this doesn't preclude the automakers from adopting the technological advancements that they're trying to get done as well. I hope we can actually have like good CarPlay with modern innovation and modern architecture behind it in a way that the car makers can swallow design-wise. And I don't know if Apple's going to be able to do that.
Yeah. It's kind of, I don't know. I get where Apple's going here, but I'm really struggling to figure out who they think this is for. Because, again, if I'm an auto manufacturer, no thank you. And it's just, I can't think of a better way to verbalize this, and I think I'm being a little bit, well, probably more than a little bit dramatic, but it's kind of like Apple hubris. Like, of course the car makers want to come to us and help us have us help them design their stuff. Why wouldn't they do that?
And, not just help them design it, but you're like, and of course they would want our branding to be part of their car.
Right, yeah.
Wouldn't they want to have some representation of Apple inside their cars?
Right, exactly.
Why? Like, it's just... I mean, like, I think the most optimistic scenario is kind of the same reason people use Apple TVs. Like, oh, I got a smart TV, but the interface on the smart TV sucks. And Apple TV is so much better. So I'm going to ignore my smart TV's built-in interface, and I'm just going to use the Apple TV. And first, I would say that's a choice people who buy an Apple TV make. But second, I think the degree to which smart televisions' built-in experiences are co-branded with the TV is much lower than the degree to which the infotainment on especially fancy modern cars is blended with the car. Like, if you look at the instrument cluster on a BMW or an Audi or a Volvo or a Polestar or one of these expensive cars, you can just look at the instrument cluster without seeing anything else, and you know what kind of car it's in. They really heavily brand that. And the good ones that do, like, their controls on, like, the other touch screens, you know, whether the climate controls are there or adjusting the seats or the 360 camera or whatever, those things are so heavily branded. Like, I mean, look at Rivian doing, like, the cel-shaded 3D model of your car and the woods and everything. That is so different than what it looks like in an Ioniq 5 versus what it looks like in a Volkswagen. Like, it's so heavily branded. Now, if you hate your car's interface, as a consumer, I can say, oh, thank God, my car's interface, I hate it. But when I get in with my phone, it erases all that and replaces it with the phone UI. I can see some people wanting to do that. But I think people buy cars based on the whole car. If someone hated, you know, I can't stand, I'm an example. If you really don't want climate controls on the touchscreen, you're not going to buy a car with climate controls on the touchscreen. Right? You're choosing based on what's in the car. In an Apple world, they're like, what if you didn't have to do that? What if you were just happy with the way we paint over all those screens with our stuff, and you never had to see your credit built-in system, and as long as you like our system, you can buy any car. I think that's their pitch for the appeal, but again, I think people holistically buy cars, and that branding is part of it. Like, if you buy some, you know, fancy, like, electric Hellcat or the E-Ray Corvette or whatever, you want the cool Corvette logo and startup animation and, like, the gauges and, like, whatever, you know, especially if they do the homages to, like, the old Corvette instrument clusters on the new one with screen. Like, that's when you're buying a Corvette, people who buy Corvettes want that. They don't want, I'm going to buy a Corvette and then I want it to look like my iPhone. No, they don't. They want it to look like a Corvette. So I'm a car person. Maybe I'm not representative of the audience, but I think we'll have to wait until this is actually implemented to see what the non-tech nerd, non-car nerd public thinks of it. But right now, it hasn't been rolled out in any cars, which I think is reflective of what the auto industry thinks of it.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a long wait for a train or car that ain't coming. All right, let's talk topics. And there is some big news that dropped sometime in the last week or two. I forget exactly when it was. Apparently, it was leaked to the Financial Times, if I'm not mistaken, and then formally stated a few days later. The European Commission has found Apple in breach of the, what is it, Digital Markets Act, the DMA? Mm-hmm. There you go. And so reading from a press release from the European Commission. The European Commission has informed Apple of its preliminary view that its App Store rules are in breach of the Digital Markets Act, or DMA, as they prevent app developers from freely steering customers to alternative channels for offers and content. In addition, the Commission opened a new non-compliance procedure against Apple over concerns that its new contractual requirements for third-party app developers and app stores, including Apple's new core technology fee, fall short of ensuring effective compliance with Apple's obligations under the DMA. In parallel, the Commission will continue undertaking preliminary investigative steps outside of the scope of the present investigation, in particular with respect to the checks and reviews put in place by Apple to validate apps and alternative app stores to be sideloaded.
Gotta love the efficiency of government, right? So all these things we've talked about on the show, their anti-steering rules, whether Apple's complying, core technology fee makes it unattractive for people to be in alternative app stores, and most recently, oh, they rejected UTM from notarization because they felt like it, right? For third-party app stores, not for the app store. They said, actually, we don't want that to be in any apps. We don't want that in our app store, and also we don't want that to be in any third-party app stores. Why? Because we said so. So they have separate investigations into all these, and this announcement was just for the anti-steering thing of, like, how easy is it for people to tell somebody in an app, hey, you can get a better deal if you go to our website. It's $10 here, but on our website, it's $5. And Apple's like, no, you can't tell them the price. If you link it, you got to do it the special way or whatever. So that's what they found them in breach of. And they say, and just so you know, we're still looking into those other things, like the core technology fee. And most recently, now, I give them a pass on the UTM thing because that happened recently, but the core technology fee was there from day one. Why is it that they can't, like, figure out all the different ways that Apple is non-compliant and tell them at once? But no, these are all separate investigations, and everything takes a long time. But anyway, if you're wondering if the European Commission thinks that Apple is following the rules of the DMA, in at least the anti-steering thing, the answer is no. They think Apple is not correctly following the rules.
And that seems like it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. I mean,
including Apple, but I'm sure it is a surprise to them.
Well, so here's the thing. Like, none of us are lawyers. We're certainly not European lawyers, right? I think I've read most of the DMA. I've said it before. I think the DMA is written in such a way that it opened the door for Apple to do something like this and to plausibly argue that they are compliant. Like, if whatever the European Commission wants, it could have been more explicit about it, right? Instead of just kind of hinting in the direction of we want competition or whatever, and in some ways it's like, well, they're not going to tell you exactly how to do it. Like, you don't want them to pin it down entirely. That's not how laws work. But in other ways, it's like, I kind of say Apple was acting in good faith, which I don't entirely think they are, but if they were, and they were trying to be compliant, they would still have a lot of questions. I don't know how much back-channel communication happens, but, like, if they were acting good faith, I would hope Apple could say to the European Commission, we're thinking of doing X, Y, and Z. Does that seem good to you? And I don't know if the European Commission is being like the App Store and saying, we can't tell you anything. Just wait till you show us what you have, and then we'll tell you about it 9 months later, right? Which is frustrating, because it's not... Like, Gruber complains about this, because he's super against the European Commission stuff, where he's like, are they saying that Apple can't make any money? There's nothing in the DMA that says Apple is not allowed to make a profit on phones or the App Store or anything like that, right? But Apple might have a question of, like, okay, well, if the core technology fee is going to be found to be non-compliant, like, what can we do? And, I mean, my answer would be, like, you can't make it so that there's no way for anyone to make a more attractive option. Because one thing that is clear in the DMA is they want more competition. And competition doesn't mean, Apple, you set the rules so nobody can ever be better than you. Like, that's clear. That's why I think their compliance is obviously, you know, in bad faith, right? But, okay, so say I accept that. How much competition? Should people be allowed to undercut us by 100%? 1,000%? Like, how unattractive can we make it, right? Can we charge people anything, or can we charge people nothing? Because if the answer is we can charge people nothing, put that in the damn DMA and say, oh, and by the way, people need to be able to sell things in third-party app stores without Apple having any say on what's there, with very narrowly defined exceptions, and also without giving Apple any money. But they didn't write that. They just didn't write that into the law as far as anything that I could see. Now, maybe I'm not a lawyer and I missed it and it's staring me in the face because it's using language that I don't understand. But I feel like this DMA could have been written to be more specific, but I am glad that Apple was found in non-compliance, because I think what they did is clearly not achieving the thing that is stated in the DMA, which is, like, we want more competition. We want a more open market. And so, you know, you think you're complying with this by making sure you have made a market that is not open, and we're going to ding you for that.
Yeah, I think there's no way to look at Apple's compliance plan and say, this is what Europe intended. Look, as John said, we are not experts in European law and the dynamics of how they write the laws and how they enforce them and everything. We do know a bit about Apple and a bit about the App Store and a bit about that kind of stuff. And it is very clear that the intention of the DMA and of allowing different app distribution channels that Apple does not financially control with arbitrary terms, that was the intention. Like, Apple should allow people who are not them to distribute software on their platform without burdensome economic terms that are dictated by Apple. That's
basically without terms that make it unattractive. Like, that's the main thing. It's like there can be terms and there can be caveats, and, you know, they have to prove a security or whatever, but you can't make the terms such that, like, nobody would ever want to do this. That you can't it's like price fixing. It's like, oh, you can compete with me, but you can't sell any products for any cheaper than I sell them. That's not actually what they're doing, but like effectively it's saying, oh, you're just going to have to pay us anyway. So we're going to try to make it so that you running the store doesn't, you don't come out ahead. The people selling it in the store don't come out ahead because they got to pay us for all those installs for 50 cents or whatever, the core technology fee. People running the stores don't come out ahead. Like, it's just nobody, if you join into the system, you're going to look over at us and say, why are we even doing this? This is basically the same as the Apple system. And that's not competition. And so Apple found a way to do that, and they think, oh, we're complying with the law. And they're going to argue, because Apple has a chance to argue about this. Say, look, we're totally in compliance. You should have written a better law. But I'm not sure that's going to work out for them.
No. And the reality is, like, obviously Europe is saying, we need people to be able to compete in this giant marketplace that is a huge part of commerce. And I think that's very defensible. You look back at history, you see things like the railroads and the telephone companies. There's a reason why we tend to promote, freer, less burdensome competition, even on a private company's assets, once it becomes a huge part of commerce that starts to be able to affect lots of other businesses, especially in anti-competitive ways. And there is no question that Apple has reached that size with the iOS platform, with the App Store. There is no question that it is that important in the entire economy. It matters a lot. So whether they should be regulated, I think that question is answered. I think the answer is yes, of course they should be regulated. And again, I mean, I'm not going to go too far into this time, because I say it all the time, but this was 100% on Apple for effectively provoking governments to regulate them with obviously blatantly anti-competitive behavior. And again, I'm kind of down on Tim Cook's strategy. I wonder what the heck he was thinking all these years of blatant anti-competitive behavior, literally provoking governments to regulate him. What did he expect to happen here? And this is a theme that we'll come back to in a little bit, but Apple definitely should have seen this coming. They rolled the dice. They said, we're going to keep doing 100% of what we're doing. We're even going to tighten the screws over the last few years. What could possibly go wrong? This is what could go wrong. So I think I am cheering on the EU for this part of the DMA. I don't love the entire law. It's a big law, and there's some weird stuff in it. But the part about ensuring freer competition for a giant app marketplace that is a keystone of modern commerce and business in so many ways and so many parts of life, I think that is 100% on point. Some of the details we can quibble over, but the idea of that is on point. And you don't have to just look at Europe. Look, Japan's now doing the same thing. It's only a matter of time before more countries around the world start doing this. And what we're going to end up with is this incredibly fragmented app store policy where Apple is going to not give an inch anywhere they're not required to. And instead, they're just going to have like 9 different rules of different where you are in the world and what kind of regional variations are necessary, and they're going to keep just being absolute turds about it all. When if they would have just eased up a little bit in a few areas that actually wouldn't have cost them that much, they could have avoided all of this and continued to have one app store for the whole world, basically, and have relatively few variations between them. And they invited this. So you know what? If the EU is going to drag them through courts and everything forever, good. They need it. They're not doing it themselves, so someone has to do it.
Yeah, they're burning so much time and energy on this, too, because it's like, if you can see the writing on the wall, like you mentioned, Japan and other countries doing similar things, then maybe Apple thinks the U.S. will never do it or whatever, but like, for the European stuff, quibbling about like, oh, they didn't write the law specifically enough, and what do they even want, and it's so weird. In the end, Apple has very limited ability to control what European governments do. Like, they have a system of government, and they apply laws to things that are sold in the EU, right? And I guess Apple can lobby the EU like any other big company can lobby them, but I feel like Apple's ability to lobby the US government as a US company is stronger than their ability to lobby the EU, and they don't seem to be particularly good at lobbying for their, for what they want, right? But like, Apple is essentially powerless. They're not part of the European government. I mean, they're not powerless because they have tons of money, but you know what I mean? Like, they, in the end, let's say Apple wins in their like appeal and some judge in Europe says or whatever, well, technically Apple did comply with how the law is written. the EU will just write a new law. Like they can't, Apple can't win this. Like, it's the same thing with the battles with China. It's like, you can either do what the Chinese government wants you to do and, you know, push back as much as you can, or you could just not be in China, like so many companies aren't, right? And it's obviously complicated for Apple because of the manufacturing or whatever, but, like, those are your choices. One of your choices is not, let's change what the Chinese government wants. Like, Apple's ability to do that, despite all their money and everything, is extremely limited. So I'm not, like, Apple is just, like, burning time and energy implementing these things to try to get away with as much as they can get away with. And in the end, the EU can just say, okay, well, we made a mistake in the law, we'll write it and we'll make it stronger. And let's just go around and around. As opposed to Apple acknowledging, what, surely Apple also understands what they're trying to get at, increased competition, and just say, let's do this once, let's do it well, let's do it globally, as we've discussed in past episodes. Imagine if they just said, look, we see the writing on the wall, everybody's going to want something more open, let's just do something that we think is open enough that will satisfy all government requirements, present and future, let's do it once, let's apply it to the whole world, let's avoid fragmentation, let's move on with our actual business. But no, they're not doing that. They're going to fight tooth and nail every single one of these things, comply as little as possible, fight it in courts, and it's just, it's wasting time and energy. It's making their platform more complicated, as we'll see when we get to the next thing. Although we do have some quotes here from the various parties to see how they're positioning themselves on the eve of this, or just after this preliminary finding on one of multiple things they're being investigated on.
Apple spokesperson Peter Ajamian, who was talking to The Verge, throughout the past several months, Apple's made a number of changes to comply with the DMA in response to feedback from developers and the European Commission. As we have done routinely, we will continue to listen and engage with the European Commission.
I mean, so that's their way of saying, you know, we're talking to them or whatever.
That's their way of saying F you.
Well, and they will continue to listen to them, engage with them. Like, see, here's the thing. There is some meaning of the minds on this, because the DMA is written with some acknowledgement that, like, it can't just be the Wild West, which is why there are carve-outs for, like, okay, Apple should have the gatekeepers, not just Apple, but gatekeepers should have the ability to reject things for security reasons from even being in third-party stores, right? The EU is not like, just let anybody do anything. It's like the PC of the 80s, right? They're not doing that. And Apple, to its credit, is trying to provide lots of security stopgaps while also allowing things, like the browser kit thing. We want to allow third-party browser engines, but we want to do that as safe as a way as possible. Ideally, all the browser engines go through the same restrictions. Safari, and all, that's not currently the case, but BrowserKit is basically built around what they already did for Safari, right? So the two parties aren't so far apart that, like, one wants completely everything open, free-for-all, and the other one wants everything locked down. They agree with each other that certain things need to be done carefully, but, like, everything else, they're like, Apple's like, how little can we get away with? How unattractive can we make third-party app stores? How little disruption to our existing business can we make? Like, we'll try to comply in a way that no one will ever take us up on any of these offers, or only a few people would, but, like, in the end, it'll just be, like, a footnote, and it won't actually change anything, right? Or maybe, like, as we'll get to in a second, maybe it'll even make things worse, and people are like, boy, we thought we would like some third-party competition, but now that we've seen it, we're going running back to the App Store because it's so much better there because of the way Apple set everything up.
Then Marguerite Vestager, I hope I have that right. I forgot to brush up on it. I apologize. But anyways, she said, the ball's now in the gatekeeper's court. They have to convince us that the measures they take will achieve full compliance with the DMA, and where this is not the case, we will intervene. We are concerned that Apple designated its new business model to discourage app developers and end users from taking advantage of the opportunities afforded to them by the DMA. The letter of the DMA is clear. Gatekeepers have to allow for alternative app stores to establish themselves on their platforms and for consumers to be fully informed about the offers available to them so that they can freely choose where they want to source their apps and at what conditions.
I would argue that the DMA is not clear, and even when she summarizes it here, like, gatekeepers have to allow for alternative app stores, Apple would say, yeah, we did that. To establish themselves on their platforms, yeah, we allow alternative app stores to be established on our platforms. For consumers to be fully informed, okay, they're going to say not fully informed. They're informed through a narrow aperture that Apple defines, and which is why they're not compliant. And so they can freely choose, and Apple would be like, yeah, they can freely choose. It's the details. Like, oh, we allow third-party app stores. We just don't want to make them any more impossible to be any more attractive than ours by applying financial burdens. And even her summary, she doesn't even say, not like that. Oh, I know you did alternative app stores, but no one wants to do them because they cost so much money and suck so much. So change that. But She doesn't. And by the way, that us that Casey read and emphasized, they have to convince us, that italic us was in her thing. I didn't add that emphasis. It was she italicized it. They have to convince us that the measures they take will achieve full compliance over the next, you know, 12 months or whatever. Like every one of these things, there's like a 9 to 12 month horizon. I'm like, okay, then Apple gets to challenge it and they have a hearing and they do a thing. And then like, people think it's going to be like, oh, we passed the law and Apple did a thing, but they're not compliant. Now they get fined. No, that's not how any of this works. It's so long between the passing of this law to the point where Apple could potentially get those huge fines that, yeah, I presumably something will be worked out. But this is just going to drag on for so long.
Yeah. And because the root of the problem is the DMA, I guess, the, you know, the EU way of doing this is not going to specify too firmly what they really intend, which is there can't be any fees. Like that, I think that's obviously what
they
intend.
I don't know if they say there can't be any, but there you have to be able to undercut the App Store. Like I don't know how they would phrase that, but like it's not competition if your competitors can never be better than you, right?
Of course.
It's just right. And the other end is free for all. Like there's no rules. The competitors can be, you know, they can if they have enough funding, they could do loss leaders and say everything is free. We'll pay you to use our App Store, like, or whatever. You know, like, there's competition is complicated because we all want competition, but there's such a thing as unfair competition. Again, like there are laws in our country about, like, you know, I think there are laws about like undercutting your competition by giving away stuff for free until all your competitors are out of business. I know that's a common thing that VC funding does these days, but I think there are actually laws in the books in certain industries where you're essentially not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to take a giant war chest of money and put all your competitors out of business by giving away milk for free until they're all out of business and you buy them all up and then you start charging twice as much for milk or something. I mean, that's what pharmaceutical companies do. But anyway, there are anti-patterns to too much competition, but we're at the other end of that spectrum right now. We're at the, like, no competition, and then, like, competition in name only, where it's not real competition. And so trying to find that balance is tricky. You can't just say, Apple, you can't charge anybody any money. I think that
might be their intention. Like, they won't say it because it is, I think that's legally a little bit tougher to argue. Hmm. But I think that what they are clearly intending is for it to be like distribution on the Mac and Windows, of just like, yeah, you should just be able to install things for free if you want to. Like that, yeah, I think that's clearly the intent, but they won't come out and say it.
Yeah, they didn't say it, and also they do have the carve-out explicitly in the thing where Apple gets to approve for security purposes and private APIs and stuff.
Right,
again,
which
the
they're
acknowledgement,
also, you know, doing in a somewhat BS-y way.
Exactly, but the fact that carve-out's there, it's like they don't actually want it to be like the Mac. You don't need to do that on the Mac. Like, you can just distribute unsigned stuff and right-click it and open it. You know what I mean? It's, and so the question, like, again, I'm not going to say, oh, well, what is Apple supposed to do? They can't tell what they want. Like, Apple clearly knows that they don't want this. Like, it is a question of, like, how open should we be? And maybe you could argue, say, this is Apple's best play. Put out the most restrictive thing possible, get slapped for it, back it off. How do you like it now? As opposed to, you know, if your goal is to do as little as possible, start from a position of doing almost nothing, like almost allowing no competition, and then back it off slowly. I just think it's going to be a waste of their time and energy, and they should have come up with something that everyone, onlookers, would consider reasonable and put that out and then see what the EU has to say. And if they put out something that was reasonable, like nominal fees to be a third-party app store, minimal oversight, the possibility of financially being way cheaper than Apple, right? And they said to the EU, that's competition, right? And the EU came back and said, actually, no, we had $0 of mine. Like you were saying, Marco, like, actually, that is the thing that they wanted to say but couldn't. That would be kind of crabby of the EU. Because if you want to say, like, and they're making the law. Like, this is not a negotiation. Like, the EU 100% makes the rules, and Apple can either choose to follow them or not be in the EU. And they didn't say, yeah, you can't charge anybody anything to have a third-party app store.
Yeah, but it does, like, I think the, whatever the... like political will and backing to get regulations like this through legislatures, wherever that comes from, I think when people are trying to argue for these laws or these regulations, I think what they have in mind is free distribution like PCs and Macs. Like, that's what people are imagining. Now, obviously, again, like legally, it's hard to require that. There's a whole bunch of snags to that, of course, because you're trying to legislate how a private company operates and makes money, and that's obviously very tricky.
I mean, are there snags to that? Because the EU does that all the time. I mean, and we just put 100% tariffs on Chinese EVs, right? So like I don't know the political situation there. You could be right that to get this passed, they couldn't be that explicit because people would be against it. But as it was written, it overwhelmingly passed. So I wonder how much leeway there is to come out and say what they really want.
Sure. But keep in mind, you know, so my point is, like, when these laws, you know, the Japan thing, the weird dating app thing in the Netherlands, and then, you know, obviously the big one, the DMA, when these are passed, I think what people have in mind is free distribution, just like Macs and PCs. And what Apple has done very well at is twisting and distorting the public discussion to, like, remember the very first time that Tim Cook was on the stand, I think in the Epic trial, I think this is where this came out, and the very first time that he presented this, it was, look, I don't have a lot of faith in Tim Cook's long-term strategy, but this was a good move from his point of view. I hated it, but from his point of view, this was a good move. When he mentioned something along the lines of, like, well, the in-app purchase fee is just the most straightforward way for us to collect our commission. How else would we collect our commission? So with that, when he said that, we all were like, what? Because what that told us was Apple believes it is entitled to collect a commission, regardless of how the money is flowing, regardless of what it's being purchased through. And Apple has successfully controlled the public narrative that all of us are talking about since then. That was, what, 2 years ago? All of us have been talking since then as if it's inevitable that, yes, of course, Apple is going to collect a fee for everything sold. And we have totally bought into their fairly brazen, you know, framing of this. We also have everybody talking about how Apple has to monetize their IP somehow. They have to. Why would anybody make software for a platform if Apple can't monetize their IP? Why would Apple continue to invest in the iPhone
if
they can't monetize their IP? Like,
certainly haven't bought into it. I don't think you have, but
no,
some people
not.
Have.
But I'm saying, like, when we're talking about this, I think it's important for everyone out there to realize, like, that entire framing of this being this inevitable thing that, of course, Apple has to collect their commission so that they can justify working on the iPhone, that is 1,000% BS, and Apple has done a great job of controlling that message and getting us all to talk about it, but that's obviously not what people want when they create these regulations. What people want is Mac and PC-like free distribution. Yes, with security controls if need be on some, you know, broad strokes, but that's what people want. Apple is the one who is refusing to give it up, and that's why this is going to take forever, as John was saying, like, because the EU is basically saying, we would like no barriers, please. And Apple is basically saying, we'd like all the barriers, please. And that it's just going to take a long time to work this out because neither of them is real. Actually, the European Commission is not really being very clear about what they want. Apple's being very clear about what they want. Apple's very clear about, we deserve everything and we're going to give up nothing and we're going to see how that goes. And so this is going to keep going on forever. But, like, you know, don't buy into Apple's framing too much when talking about this, because that came out of nowhere 2 years ago. That was not what anybody was ever thinking. And, I mean, just to rehash everything, like, they have plenty of reason to invest in the iPhone to maintain iOS and their developer tools without collecting a fee on every single app transacts.
The reason that the premise plays so well in America is it's so American. It's like, you're going to tell a company how they can make money. You're going to tell them they can't make money in a particular way. That's not fair. They should be able to do what they want and let the market decide. And, like, the whole, like, so the premise Tim Cook was offering was, like, you know, unchangeable premise, we have to make money. All we're arguing about is how we can do that, and in-app purchase is the best way, and we can try other ways or whatever. But, like, it's like, I reject your premise, right?
Right.
You know, you don't need it, right? But in the same way, like, this, the premise of like, U.S. business is like, well, companies should be able to make money however they want, and if they pick a lousy way that people don't like, people won't buy from them. The premise of the DMA, as you stated before, is that Apple has power in a market that's super important, and they have too much power, and so the government needs to step in to tell companies what to do. What you could do when you were a small company, now suddenly we're saying, because you sell phones, and because you're this big, and because you're successful, and because phones are so important, we are saying new rules apply to you. That's exactly what the DMA is. We don't really have anything like that in the U.S. quite yet, but exactly, and there's various DOJ cases, but anyway, but that we talked about in past episodes, but the DMA. That's the premise of the DMA. The premise is you specifically, gatekeepers, new rules apply to you. But the American mind rebels at the idea of a government telling companies how they can make money. And so people are, you know, like groomers are so incredulous. So you're telling them that they can't make money the way they want to from their phone? And it's like, yes, because specifically, like he even says like the Japan thing, like, oh, imagine if the Japanese game console makers, we should tell them, oh, well, guess what? You know, you have to allow third-party apps on your PlayStation or whatever. Game consoles are not as important as phones. Like, that's what it comes down to. The premise of these cases is it's not like every company that's like this. It's technological gatekeepers for platforms that are so important to all of life and commerce that these rules apply to them. And gaming is big, but so far, right now, I'm going to say game consoles are not as important to the life and economy of a country as cell phones. That's the determination made by many of these laws and lawsuits, and I agree with that determination. Game consoles aren't as important. They're more important than they used to be, and they are important, and maybe something could be looked at there, but if I had to say which is more important, it's the cell phone. It's no contest. It's just so much more important. And so, yeah, these people are passing laws specifically targeting gatekeepers for platforms that are super important in our life. And it can seem unfair. Again, you know, why do the game consoles get away with it? Because they're less important. Maybe someday they'll come for the game consoles. Where do you draw the line? How do you decide when somebody is too powerful? We talked about this before. When do you have a monopoly? What percentage is required? When is there too little competition? These are all complicated questions. But the premise of all of these things is Apple, new rules apply to you and Microsoft and, you know, Google and all these things because of exactly what you make and how important you are and how much power you have. And some people just don't accept that. And the same way we don't accept Tim Cook's premise that he just has to make money, some people don't accept the premise of the DMA. And so they're never going to be happy with what the DMA does. No details about a negotiation of the DMA, no compliance, malicious or otherwise, is going to be satisfying because they disagree with the premise that Apple deserves to be regulated, and so do other companies like it.
Right. So all this is going on, and around the same time, give or take a few days, actually, I think it was a few days before the EU's announcement, but nevertheless, one way or another, it's around the same time. Apple has declared that it may delay some of its AI features and others in the EU because of the DMA. Ooh, Nelly. All right. So reading from The Verge.
This went over like a lead balloon.
Now, reading from The Verge. Apple says upcoming features like its Apple Intelligence generative AI tools, iPhone mirroring, and SharePlay screen sharing may not be available in the EU this year. So now, quoting Apple, 2 weeks ago, Apple unveiled hundreds of new features that we are excited to bring to our users around the world. We are highly motivated to make these technologies available to all users. However, due to the regulatory uncertainties brought about by the Digital Markets Act, or DMA, we do not believe that we will be able to roll out three of these features, iPhone mirroring, SharePlay screen sharing enhancements, and Apple Intelligence, to our EU users this year. Specifically, we are concerned that the interoperability requirements of the DMA force us to compromise the integrity of our products in ways that risk user privacy and data security. We are committed to collaborating with the European Commission in an attempt to find a solution that would enable us to deliver these features to our EU customers without compromising their safety.
So this is one of the aspects of the DMA that is either the DMA overreaching us not understanding what the DMA wants. The idea is
working in los dos.
Yeah, or all those integrations that Apple has where there's some feature that, I mean, this isn't a DOJ case. Apple Watch only works with the Apple iPhone, and this iPhone mirroring thing between Macs and iPhones only works with iPhones, not Android phones. Like, any feature that you can imagine Apple rolling out, there's some interpretation of the DMA, and again, maybe it's straightforward interpretation, not a lawyer, that says, hey, if you add a feature, you can't confine that feature to only first-party stuff. Those features need to be, you know, extensible by third parties and pluggable on day one. And as anyone who's familiar with Apple's platform knows, that's not the way they do things. Like, sometimes they roll out first-party only for years and years and never allow third parties access. Sometimes they do a third-party one 5 years later, 10 years later, right? Like, think of all the features we have. How long did we got third-party keyboards? How long until apps were allowed to run in the background that weren't Apple's apps? Like, on the Mac, on iPhone and iPad, all these platforms, they don't always make it extensible by third parties ever, and doing it on day one is rare. So if the DMA really does require every gatekeeper to implement every feature such that it is extensible and open to third parties on day one, I think that is a technologically ill-considered requirement. And Apple would be justified in saying, we just can't roll out these new features because it seems like they are not going to be compliant with the law. Now, interestingly, they weren't so hesitant to roll out all the other things that we said that we also agreed were probably not compliant, like the core technology fee and all the rules for alternative app stores. Somehow they didn't, their worry about whether those would be compliant did not stop them from deploying those. But these ones, Apple says, you know what? We're afraid we might not be compliant, so it's best that we don't roll these out. I don't know if they're compliant. If they're not compliant, the DMA in this respect is bad and needs to be changed, because you can't require technology companies to only launch something when it's ready for the world to extend it. That is too high a bar. That's not the right way to make technology. You can put a timeline on it, say it has to be extensible within 5 years. There are other things you could do to be more reasonable about this. But I would also say that, like, look, yeah, Apple's an important platform. Cell phones, gatekeeper cell phones, Android, Google, whatever. Those are super important platforms. They're important to the economy, all that stuff, right? It doesn't mean that you need to require them to be open in every respect. What's the most important way they need to be open? You need to be able to get apps from somewhere else. Does every single aspect of that platform also need to be open? Every feature, everything that you can do on it, every single minute thing, SharePlay, iPhone Mirror, does every single thing need to be open to third parties at all time? How about you wait to see if iPhone mirroring is a lever that Apple uses to dominate the industry before you decide that that needs to be opened up? Because we know the App Store is, right? So yeah, address the App Store and the law, but you can't make an open-ended thing that says every little feature you add has to be open from day one. It's pointless, it's counterproductive, and in the end, does it matter if iPhone mirroring only works with iPhones? Probably not to the degree that there should be a law addressing it. So I really hope that the DMA actually doesn't try to say everything in the OS open from day one. And again, even if it did say that, Apple should probably just launch these features anyway. But that's not why they're holding them back. They're holding them back to kind of show the world, we think this law is crappy, and we're going to demonstrate that by holding back goodies that we were probably going to hold back anyway, because Apple Intelligence is only supposed to be launching in English in the fall anyway. And I guess they could launch it in English in Europe because lots of people speak English there. But like, this is part them making a statement about their interpretation of the DMA, and part sort of act of defiance to show the consequences. And it's like, hey, Apple could just pull out of the EU and not sell phones there. Like, that is the ultimate, like, breakup move here. That's the Brexit. We need to come up with a Brexit-like term for Apple pulling out of the EU. I don't have a good one off the top of my head, but sure, by next week we'll have lots of suggestions. That hasn't happened exit? Yet. But that, what did you call it?
Exit. Because it begins with the
it has
E.
to be like an Apple thing, like Britain exit, Brexit.
Exit?
You know?
I don't know.
If they core the Apple?
Well, anyway, we'll see what we come up with.
We'll workshop it.
That's lurking out the end of this disagreement. But this move by Apple of just, you know, again, maybe they weren't going to roll this out anyway. Like, but either way, this is a positioning move. Like, we don't know whether they're doing something they weren't going to do. Maybe this is just putting words around something that was going to happen anyway. But yeah, this is an escalation. Let's say I would call this an escalation.
Well, the thing of it is that I feel like I was going to say squint, but I'm not even sure it requires me squinting. I can look at the DMA and look at particularly the mirroring and SharePlay screen sharing stuff, and I can see an interpretation, a legitimate, honest, you know, no BS interpretation that, wow, this may not fly with the DMA. Maybe we should hold on to this. And I can legitimately argue that is a real concern.
But they didn't have that same concern about all the other stuff they rolled out. Well, you could have the same exact statement about, wow, this may not comply. Maybe we should hold it back.
I think because these are additive things that involve interoperability between devices, right? And leaving aside the nuance of these particular selections, the broader point I'm trying to make is that I feel like we have, and we, the three of us have talked about this a lot, Apple has not really read the room, both in a micro level and a macro level. At a micro level, they haven't really read the room that, look, the EU is not going to like this, man. Like, they're not going to take this lying down and be like, oh, you know what? We messed up. Yeah, we screwed this all up. That's our bad. That's on me. My bad. That's not what's going to happen. And on a macro level, it's fascinating to me what Marco said, because I had the exact same reaction. Marco said a minute ago, this went over like a lead balloon. And I think that's broadly accurate. I think most people had that same reaction. And it took me thinking about it a little bit, and I'm actually not so grumpy about this anymore, but I certainly was at first. And what's fascinating to me is everyone seems to, broadly speaking, everyone seems to assume ill intent from Apple, right? Like, they're doing this just to hold up a middle finger to the European Commission and say, well, nah, 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 you can't have cool stuff. And that very well may be true, for the record. I don't know. But it's kind of funny and unfortunate that because Apple has been so belligerently stubborn about so much, and I think Marco was saying this as well earlier, they've been so stubborn about so much and haven't given a friggin' inch. And so because of that, everyone is just like, well, this is Apple being a dick again. It's news at 11, like, yeah, same as it ever was. And that's the thing that kind of bums me out as someone who I consider myself a fan of the company to the degree that anyone can be a fan of a, you know, company. And this bumps me out. It's, you know, as we've said many different times on the show over the years, you know, all of a sudden I'm looking around and, or maybe Apple should be looking around and asking, are we the baddies? Because this is baddie behavior. Like, if this is them thumbing their nose at the European Commission, it's just gross. And I can't get past, and I know I'm repeating what Marco said before and what we've said many times on the show, I can't get past, this is an own goal.
Mm-hmm.
Apple knew this was coming. They could tell it was coming. Anyone with three brain cells that followed this could tell this was going to happen, and that the laws are going to change, and they're going to change because Apple is greedy and they're entitled, and they just wouldn't give an inch. And now they screwed around, and now they're finding out.
Yeah, and the thing is, and I think both sides of this are correct. Like, two things can be simultaneously true.
Yeah.
Apple's actually probably correct that these features, there, you could see why they actually might be against the interop requirements of the DMA, which are terrible largely. Like, you can see why. Like, yes, Apple is probably correct to cite this as a problem with the DMA, with these things in particular. Like, that's probably technically correct, but also, saying this and doing this and having to face this dilemma at all is a direct result of their blatant anti-competitive behavior over time. So, none of this would have happened if not for that.
That's debatable. I mean, you could say that no matter what Apple would have done, something like DMA would have passed anyway. There's no amount of opening up preemptively that Apple could have done. I still think they should have done it because, like, you don't know that you couldn't have prevented it. This is the question everyone has. Could Apple have done anything to prevent it? And I think we all agree it was worth finding out. Try something, right? Instead of doing nothing, yeah, right? And again, I want to remind people, Apple did loosen the App Store rules from 30% to 15%, the small business program. Like, stuff like that was, like, arguably Apple's reaction to seeing the writing on the wall. Obviously, it was very slight, very limited, not at all anything close to something that would have preempted action, clearly, right? But there is still, I'm willing to entertain the idea that there is really nothing Apple could have done. But I just would have liked to seen them try. Show me there's nothing you could have done by giving a big, good faith effort to self-regulate, to head off regulation. Maybe you would have failed, but they didn't even make an effort. And so I think that's what we're arguing. And I'm not 100% convinced that they could have prevented something like this. But they should have tried, because I think their odds were okay. Like, it wasn't impossible, right? It was, you know, there's probably something they could have done. And even if they didn't head it off, even if they did some good faith thing that really opened it up and made new worldwide rules that they thought would be compliant, but something like the DMA passed anyway, and it turns out they're not quite in compliance, then you're tweaking an existing worldwide system to comply. Like, you're probably closer to a meeting of the minds about this, right? As opposed to now, where they're just so far apart and it's so adversarial. And even for this, like, I think if you really want to demonstrate, like, again, if Apple's and the popular interpretation of DMA is such that, like, these interop rules really would forbid iPhone mirroring and SharePlay and stuff, right, and Apple Intelligence, ship the features, have the EU strike them down, and then throw up your hands and go, see, everybody? That's how dumb the DMA is. It doesn't allow us to ship iPhone mirroring. iPhone mirroring is not a giant lever of power that we use to dominate the industry. It's a tiny feature that benefits people. If stuff like iPhone mirroring is disallowed, that's why the DMA is dumb. But they didn't allow that to happen. They should have shipped it, and got the complaints about it and had the evidence. Instead, now they're holding it back saying, we think this might not be compliant. And of course, the EC is not going to come out and say, Apple's wrong, it would have been compliant. Or Apple's right, it wouldn't have been. The EC is acting like the App Store. It's like, if you don't submit the app, we're not going to tell you whether it's compliant or not, right? Mm-hmm. So they've lost the opportunity to show that the DMA is dumb, right? And on the flip side, the EC, I guess, doesn't have the opportunity to show the DMA isn't dumb by saying, hey, ship iPhone mirroring. We weren't going to strike that down. Like, we're reasonable people here. I don't know. I don't know if iPhone mirroring is compliant with the DMA or not. Neither does Apple. I'm not sure if the EC knows. If maybe they need 9 months to investigate to find right?
Well, I think Apple knows that is probably a like something like they're looking for holes to poke in the DMA because they don't like the whole thing. They're looking for reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
They're looking for ways to make it look overbearing and ridiculous. And this is, you know, the main difference here is that with this move for the first time, they're not just attacking, you know, policies. With this move, they're attacking their own customers. And that is, I think, again, I question the strategy here. Is anyone strategizing over there? Like, what?
They may be thinking that Europe is filled with Americans who are going to be like, hey, the government's stopping us from getting our cool Apple features, where it seems like a lot of people in the EU are going to say, hey, Apple's being a jerk about this law that we all agreed on.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Because again, Europeans largely like the way Europe does things.
Yeah, exactly, right? If Europe was filled with Texans, it would be a different story, but it's not, right? It's just... And so I don't know if they're misreading that room. Again, I don't have the finger on the pulse of what Europe is like. But just look, the DMA passed overwhelmingly. The EU likes regulation. Just look at all the laws around, like, cheeses in Italy and stuff. It's just like they like the way things work there, right? They vote for these people, right? And so I don't know how this is going to work out. But just I do think if this is the deal with the DMA, like, Apple can no longer do business effectively in Europe because – again, I think it's not reasonable to require every single feature added to all of their gatekeeping platforms to be open to third parties from day one. It's technologically not feasible. So if the DMA is asking for that, it needs to be changed, or Apple just needs to leave. Because otherwise, people in Europe are going to get features like 3 years after the rest of the world gets them. And that's if Apple decides to stay in the market and put in an effort to actually comply. Because that's the best case, the roadmap. Like, you roll out the feature, and then you tweak the feature, and then maybe you open it up to third parties. And then the next year, the third-party integration actually works well, right? And that's not Apple being a jerk. That's just the way technology works. It's not reasonable to require this. The App Store is the important thing to regulate on the phone. SharePlay is not.
Right, but it was their behavior with the App Store that that generated a whole bunch of political will to do a law like this in the first place. That happened to also include other things. I mean,
yeah, but, you know, and again, it's not clear to me that SharePlay, like, they wanted to wrap up SharePlay in this. Like, maybe they're like, oh no, we totally understand. Like, SharePlay is not what we're after, or whatever. But I don't know.
No, but they're looking for reasons to discredit it. But I have to wonder, how many battles is Apple willing to fight at once? Like, they
have a lot of lawyers.
They're doing battle with everyone. They're fighting on so many fronts, and they seem to just provoke more of them to keep coming. And now they've involved a pretty decently sized chunk of their own customers as one of the fronts in these battles. Why is this worth it? Because again, what we're talking about is not all services revenue. First of all, a huge chunk of it is Google. So setting that aside, what we're talking about is not even all App Store revenue. We are talking about giving people the option to not use App Store purchasing and commissions. And even then, there's a lot of, rails around that. There's a lot of guardrails around that. But we're just talking about permitting the option for apps that are largely not using the App Store purchase system in the first place. Things like Spotify, Netflix, HBO Max, like, that's kind of what we're talking about here. We're talking about allowing these apps to, like, link out and use their own stores or to use their own purchase systems that already mostly aren't using in-app purchase. And that's not where Apple makes most of its money. They make most of their money with games. So we're not even talking about a huge chunk of App Store revenue that would just disappear overnight. Like, that's the thing is, like, for Apple is engaging in all these different battles all around the world, including in their own country now with the DOJ lawsuit, which touches on some of these things, they're opening up all these fronts of war and battling and literally causing problems for their core product attributes like integration in the EU now and possibly the DOJ lawsuit. That those both have integration components. They are causing substantial threats to really important parts of how their products are designed and how they work in pretty large markets around the world in order to save some tiny percentage of App Store revenue. That, to me, I have yet to see. I was trying to think, what are Tim Cook's long-term strategy successes? I can't think of many of those. I honestly do not think Tim Cook as a leader has good long-term strategy in some pretty key critical areas to leading this company. And honestly, it's time for new leadership. It really is. We've seen the limits of the Tim Cook Apple. We've seen he's really good at making money, and he's a little spotty in some of the really important product details and a little bit, you know, short-sighted with some of these, you know, regulation and App Store details. We've seen the limits of Tim Cook's Apple. I'm ready to see something else. This is bad leadership and bad strategy at the top.
This wouldn't be an Apple DMA rant if Marco wasn't ready to fire some people at Apple.
what would you call a profound failure of strategy that's now a fact that's trying to preserve a tiny part of revenue in exchange for damaging huge amounts of the product line?
It's potentially a small part, but like let's say all those games where all the revenue comes from all go to third party payment vendors and Apple no longer gets in-app purchase revenue from them. Like anyway, like
here's the thing. The phone has built-in payment system. The reason why it was so powerful and so compelling to integrate that as an app developer is because you have massive conversion rates when you use Apple's built-in system. You don't have to have people sign up for some other system. So there's huge conversion rates there. Also, tons of the App Store money comes from children. Many children's devices wouldn't have any other credit card systems built into them, or they would be disallowed by policy, or the parents wouldn't give the kids the credit card or whatever. So there's built-in value there. There's huge reasons to use it. And by the way, the big question, this is, you know, taking a page from Ben Thompson and a little bit of dithering, but mostly Ben Thompson. What if they just said, hey, games still have to use the system, but other apps can use their own? Because there is, with the sole exception of Epic, which doesn't seem to be going that well, there is almost no regulatory pressure from the games angle. The pressures are coming from people like Spotify and streaming platforms and Amazon and like things like that. Like it's non-game apps that make the best case for relaxing some of these anti-competitive rules. The games side of it really is not providing much legal and regulatory ammo for this. It's really mostly
coming
from the
app
side.
There are game developers in Europe.
I mean, there's a few, but
I don't know what their lobbying power is, but I feel like if you give an inch there, the game developers would eventually come for you. It's debatable. I mean, obviously, we've talked about this before, like that services revenue, which includes the App Store, is the one growth area for Apple. So even knocking that curve down a little bit is, you know, from a Tim Cook perspective, like, oh, the one line that we had going up is now tilting, so it's not going up quite as steeply, and that's super bad because we don't have the other lines that are even going up anymore.
Yeah, but now he's going to take 30% of OpenAI.
The question is, like, is this a matter of principle? And that's what leadership is stuck on? Or is it a leadership strategy, which I've said many times, like they're making the bet that they can outlast this, that by being stubborn and, you know, dragging it out, that in the end they will persevere because they have, you know, to your point, there aren't regular elections that are constantly changing leadership at Apple, right? And so the leadership in all these various countries will change, and maybe the next administration or parliament or regime or whatever will be more conducive. And meanwhile, here we are, steady at the tiller, Apple just being stubborn through all of it, and we think we can come out ahead. We have the best lawyers, we have more money than you, and we're going to be around long after you're retired, you know. So that it could be a strategy like that, or it could be, oh, it's the principle, we just deserve to make money from our platform. Like it could be leadership at Apple disagreeing with the premise that Apple and other gatekeepers should be regulated. And a lot of people do disagree with that. They think, I don't agree. I don't think just because we're a cell phone company and we have this much power that we should be regulated. We don't have a monopoly. We think it's a competitive market. We don't think we should be regulated, right? If that's the attitude, if it's like the principle of the matter, then yeah, it's not going to change until Tim Cook retires and someone else takes over. Which, again, the time horizon for that is not that long. When Tim Cook said he's probably not going to be here for 10 more years, that was however many years ago. So keep watching the clock there. But I don't think, like, I don't think anyone could look at this and say, oh, he needs to be fired right now because he made some catastrophic mistake, right? You can look back on his legacy and say, oh, doing all the manufacturing in China, probably your worst decision, but also your best decision, so we're not sure how to judge you, right?
I mean, that's the thing. Like, look at large Tim Cook strategies. Where, tell me the success stories there. I would say he's done good work with environmentalism. What
manufacturing else? In China is a huge success story, but also potentially one of the worst things long term.
Right, again, long term strategy. Like, look, that's the thing.
But it was like, what's
like
long term?
Steve Ballmer made tons of money for Microsoft.
Right, no, but
long term was not good.
But what was long term? Like, is just 15 years not count as long term? Like, what? It's like, oh, that doesn't count as long term because we can see in a future when we can see how manufacturing China is really making things difficult in long, long term. But Tim Cook would say, when I made that decision or when that decision was made, we got 20 years of the biggest profits ever and amazing products that we couldn't have made anywhere else. So how is that a bad decision? Anyway, I'm retiring now. It's the next person's problem, right? You know, sit down and write two letters, Casey.
Nope.
I don't know if you know that one.
Nope.
Okay. Anyway, Yeah, well, I mean, when Tim Cook finally does retire, because I don't think he's going to be pushed out, we'll take another look at this. But, like, you know, there's no easy decisions in companies of this big. And while I also disagree with the way the company has been handling this, I can see the argument, not the principled one, like that we don't need to be regulated because that's just being stubborn, but I can see the argument that their strategy is the best way to handle this. I disagree with it. But I see it and I could make it, and it's not ridiculous, right? That this is the best strategy to come through this with the most benefit, right? Even though I disagree with it, I can see it. But yeah, it's frustrating because the leadership, that's one of the things about Apple, leadership has been so steady. Like, even though, you know, Jobs died and Cook took over, like, it seems like a continuation of the same regime, right? And it may be even worse because it's almost like certain things got sort of like stuck in amber. Right. Like that Jobs felt so much more free to change his mind and turn on a dime, whereas certain values that seem to extend from the job eras look like they've been set in stone in like Tim Cook's head. And he is not as mercurial as they used to say in the 80s as Steve Jobs. He's not seemingly prone to turn on a dime. Almost everything that he's doing, he's been doing from day one and just steadily plugging away, like the environment, like manufacturing in China, like being stubborn about the App Store, right? We keep hoping that one day he'll wake up and say, you know, we've gone about this all wrong, but it could be that just it can't be him to do that. The only person who's ever going to do that is the next person. Steve Jobs, the very same person, could make 17 different decisions in every possible different direction over the course of a decade, and that was just one guy. But Tim Cook seems pretty dead set on this App Store thing.
All right. Hello, future Marco.
Hi.
I feel like maybe we should quit here, but you tell me.
Yeah, we basically got through all of the
I
top...
think this is good.
Are we going to try to do Ask ADP?
Well, that's what that was my next question. Do we want to do like one or two or maybe
let's
even
do
a full trio?
Yeah.
All right. Let's do at least a little bit of Ask ATP. It's been busy season for us, so we've unfortunately put it on the back burner. Let's bring it around. Some fellow by the name of Todd Vaziri, I wonder who he is, writes, an ATP 589 used Mark Gurman's rumor bullet points as a conversation starter. Rumors are great at sparking conversation and debate, but I wonder if anyone has ever revisited Gurman's rumors post-event to validate the rumors themselves. It seems like no one cares if the rumors are actually based on fact and bear fruit, since the rumors help create quote-unquote content and discourse that's good enough for some. But when rumors that ultimately go nowhere are given full faith, I feel like we are all wasting outrage or interest. Not to mention, if a rumor doesn't come true, the rumor monger can claim that Apple changed its plans and claim no responsibility. I feel like my gut says that Gurman is more, he is over 50%, but I've never actually done any mathematics or anything to see if that's true.
Yeah, back in the early days before you guys were Apple fans, in the, God, I hope I'm going to get this right. macOS rumors. I know you're like, don't you mean Mac rumors? No, I'm pretty sure I mean macOSrumors.com. Anyway, there was a lot of websites that had Apple rumors. Some of those websites just flat made up stuff. Right. Some of those websites would publish things that were sent to them anonymously that the senders made up. And it was a very exciting time to be an Apple fan because every possible thing that you could think would be like, well, look at this, look at that. And back in that time, I thought to myself, kind of like Todd here, it would be great if there was like a meta website that kept track of all the things that were on all the rumors websites and then rated them on accuracy. And there are websites currently that do that. I wish I could remember the URLs. Probably we'll have them follow up next week if anyone cares. But there are websites that do that. But it turns out that activity is not that exciting because very quickly you kind of get a feel for what kind of things will people publish. Like, will this site publish anything that's sent to them anonymously? Or will this site only publish things from sources that they have some reason to believe are actual real sources, not just like an anonymous email that comes to you or whatever? Mark Gurman is one of those people who publishes things from sources. The main thing against him is that the sourced information that he gets is usually buried in a giant pile of words, a lot of which are just his opinion on things. And it's like, yeah. What did your sources tell you? And the reason we care what his sources tell us is because his hit rate for things that are sourced that he says definitively, very close to when they're actually going to happen, and even sometimes distantly, is very good. He has real sources. He doesn't have people making things up. He's not guessing and being lucky. He has actual sources, or maybe just one source, but whatever it is, when he publishes information without any qualifiers and says something definitively, and it's like a week before the keynote, you can basically take that to the bank. Rare misses like the Apple Watch and everything or whatever. But the reason we go back to that and talk about it as if it's a real thing is because, like, well, it is a week before WWDC and Gurman says no hardware at WWDC. We just take that at face value at this point. Because when he says that definitively a week before WWDC, guess what? No hardware at WWDC. And if he starts being wrong about that, he said no hardware and it was a huge hardware thing, then we're going to look askance. As I think the Apple Watch rumor with the flat sides that never occurred, we look a little bit askance at that. Not 100%, but he has real sources. As opposed to macOS rumors back in the day, which I'm pretty sure had no real sources and just published anything that sounded cool and occasionally got things right just because of, you know, dumb luck and occasionally got real leaks, but most of the time just made up stuff. In the end, this is mostly like entertainment or whatever. But I think on this show, if something is a rumor that's like we have no idea about the sourcing or whatever, we will say as much. But when we say it looks like no hardware at WWDC because Gurman said it, that's based on past performance that he's been pretty accurate about things like that. Farther out, like, oh, the new Apple Watch is going to have different straps. Like, remember when we talked about that ages ago? We were always framing that as like, it's so far away. Who knows if that's going to happen? He might have a source that just like, even then it's like source. Oh, okay. Well, so they were working on an idea for a new strap on Apple Watch things. And he got a sourced rumor to say that. That doesn't mean, and Gurman doesn't say definitively the next Apple Watch will have different straps. He's just saying, this is the thing Apple's working on. And it probably is, but you have to take that for what it is, which is Apple works on a lot of stuff. Not everything ships. Sometimes they decide to do something different or whatever. That's different than when he comes out and says, here are the features, here are the things, here's what's going to be in the keynote, here's what's not going to be in the keynote, again, especially as the day gets closer. So I agree that just getting outraged on stuff that are just rumors is pointless, but I hope mostly on this show we either talk about rumors as a jumping off point to like imagine if they did this or whatever, or we take as close to fact things that have come from sources that are usually right very close to the date when they're going to happen.
Yeah, and different rumor sources have different areas of strengths, I would say. Like, for instance, when we hear from Ming-Chi Kuo about a new display size or a new display panel that could be used for an Apple product, that's usually pretty good because Ming-Chi Kuo is well-sourced in the supply chain for displays, and we know
that. But we don't know what product that's going to be in.
Right, exactly.
And very often he will definitively say, this is going to be in a new laptop, and it turns out it's in an iPad or something, right?
Right.
Because that's not something you would know if you just have sources at the display manufacturer.
Right, and sometimes you can derive it, like, you know, if it's some giant, you know, 30-inch 8K panel, like, that's probably for a studio display, not, like, a MacBook, but, you know. There are some things that it's more vague, but yeah, like we know when Ming-Chi Kuo reports pretty definitive like display size stuff, especially when it's something like an iPhone
or like the OLED correct. iPad. We were talking about the OLED iPad as if we were sure it was a thing for months and months and months, because there are just so many sources in the display supply chain for so long saying iPad size OLEDs, dual layer iPad size OLEDs. Like, it's not just one source. It's tons of them come in, and it's like eventually we just start talking about it as if it's fact. And maybe that's just like experience and kind of knowing, like, and you know, it looks like there's going to be OLED iPads with dual layer screens, and there was. And every time that happens, it reinforces our instincts of when something, like, where there's smoke, there's fire, versus just like a fanciful idea of like, I think they're looking at different ways to attach watch straps.
Right, exactly. And we know, like, you know, Mark Gurman has limits too. Like, Mark Gurman oftentimes will miss the marketing side of something, or the story, or the software details of certain things. Like, but he's really good at, like, hardware. Like, Mark Gurman usually knows what hardware is coming. He knows usually some pretty good hardware details, and he's actually getting seemingly better sources over time. And so, you know, we pay attention to that. Like, we notice that, but we don't treat rumors as, like, absolute facts. But usually, like, you know, we also see the patterns. Like, we know that if there's pretty strong rumors about some new iPhone display size from Ming-Chi Kuo, and then, you know, a few months later, Mark Gurman reports a few more details about an iPhone of that size, and we know that's a plausible size and it's bigger than the existing ones and stuff. Like, we know that's probably true, just because we've seen the patterns before. We know roughly how this goes. I mean, we've been doing this for a long time, and so we're not going to report on things on the show or talk about them as if they're facts if they seem really far-fetched, or at least we'll tell you why we think it's far-fetched if everyone else is talking about it and we feel like we need to. But, you know, it's all – most of it is just kind of like gut feeling, putting in context, like, this sounds plausible from this source that is usually good in this area versus this thing from some rando account on Twitter that no one's ever heard of before is probably wrong.
And see, sometimes we don't even need rumors. Like, for example, we talked about on past episodes, OLED screens are coming to MacBooks. I don't even think there's a rumor of that, but it's like, duh, right? Unless some better technology comes along, eventually the screen, cool screens they just put on the iPads should be coming to MacBooks. Now, what we'll end up reporting on is, say there's a rumor that says, oh, it turns out they can't use the Tandem OLEDs in MacBooks because someone on the supply chain says they use too much power, they get too hot, or something like that. That's a rumor we report on. But in the absence of any rumors, we're just like, well, we assume these displays will come to the MacBooks. Now we wait to see, does the rumor mill support that and say, oh, here's the schedule for the MacBook Air with a dual-layer OLED display, right? Here's when we think it's coming out, 2025, 2026, and they'll keep updating that date when they get it or whatever. Or are we looking for a rumor that says Apple changed their mind? They're not using a micro-LED on the watch, for example. Like, they did all this investment in micro-LED. They were going to use it on the watch, and they said, no, actually, we're not. We've bailed out of that. We sold the company or whatever. Those are things worth reporting on, but even in the absence of reporting, you can look ahead, and you can kind of see where the tech is going, what is going to be technologically possible. Look at the products Apple's introduced. Look at what technologies they would probably want to use in the rest of their line and see how that goes. And then, obviously, there's the easy stuff of like, hey, you know, Apple has an M4. There's probably going to be a more powerful than M4 chip, which, historically speaking, will probably be an M4 Pro and M4 Max, and maybe there'll be an Ultra, maybe there'll be an Extreme. You don't need rumors to tell you that the M4 is coming to the Mac line. Like, you just don't need any. And all we do is look at the rumors and say, okay, it looks like this is coming in this year and this is coming in this month or whatever, to sort of lay out where they're coming. But no one is debating, like, someone said the M4 is coming to the MacBook Pro? I'm not sure about that. No, we're pretty sure.
Hello again, Future Marco.
Hi.
Do we want to call it there, or do we want to keep going?
That's pretty good. Let's do that.
All right.
And then for overtime, let me scroll. God, thinner
devices.
Long. Where the heck is this? So
yeah, there's a lot of topics.
It's way down.
There it is. There's the red. Okay. All right. Thank you for... there's no sponsors this week.
Whoops and oopsies. Yeah. Should have warned you. Sorry.
All right. Thank you to our members who were the exclusive sponsor of this episode. We are 100% member supported this week. Please consider joining us at atp.fm/join. And if you do join, you get a few different perks and benefits, including every week the ATP Overtime segment. This is a bonus topic that we do every week just for members. And this week it's going to be about Apple allegedly planning thinner devices, seemingly across the whole product line. Yeah, speaking of Gurman rumors, we were talking about this Apple thinner device rumor, which seems plausible and I think has some interesting implications. We'll talk about that in overtime this week. So you can join to hear it. atp.fm/join. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you next week. So what's going on with Aaron's car? Any updates there?
Yes, I have updates. So last week we recorded early because the List family went to one of our favorite places in the world, Cape Charles on the eastern shore of Virginia. This is where we do our summer beach vacation every year, and so we went on Sunday. The house we stayed at had a Sunday turn. And Monday I think it was afternoon. Oh no, Monday morning, we got a call from the adjusters saying, "Hey, I'm at Volvo. Can you explain to me what the hell happened one more time?" Like, as we had never spoken to the adjuster before. And I was like, "I can, but why don't I put, you know, my wife on the phone? She was the one who's there, you know, blah, blah, blah." So she does, you know, the whole song and dance about, you know, what had happened, et cetera, et cetera. Then I'm pretty sure it was Monday evening. So that same evening, the adjuster calls again. We are about to go to dinner and the adjuster calls. We're literally getting on, you know, going out the door to get in our, you know, borrowed golf cart to go to dinner. And the adjuster calls and he says, "Okay, I have looked into the situation and we're going to total the car."
Oh my God.
Because the car is worth not that much more than it would cost to repair it. So we're going to total the car. That means that now we have to buy a car under duress because Erin can't drive my car, doesn't think she can. And we do have, I don't remember if we talked about this when we spoke last, but she did get a loaner from our local Volvo dealer. It is a piece of trash, but it's a piece of trash that will get her from A to B as long as A to B is pretty close to home. And so we are very thankful for this piece of trash, but it is not a long-term sustainable solution, right? And service has been phenomenal. Like if you live in the Richmond area or anywhere near it and you want to get your car serviced, you know, by somebody who seems to really care, go to Volvo of Richmond. They're very good. But that being said, you know, we still need to solve this problem. And so we haven't yet received the money from Allstate. We are working through that process right now, but you know, we've started car shopping. And so I could go on for about 3 hours about this, but I will try to make it quick. We started by looking at what was at Volvo of Richmond. And I don't remember if we talked about this previously on the show, even as recently as last week. But when we bought Aaron's car, we bought it new in 2017. And we did that because we really, really, really wanted, or I really, really, really wanted something with CarPlay. And at the time, the XC90 of this generation, and it's been refreshed since then, but it's mostly the same. The XC90 of that generation was only like a year old. And so you aren't really going to find a used car that's for a model that's as no more than a year old. And so we bought new. And I stand by that decision, although I'm not so sure if Erin does now that her car has died 7 years later. But nevertheless, I stand by that decision. But now we have the luxury of a very robust used market in theory, because, you know, it's been out for quite a long time. And so we started looking at used cars and Volvo of Richmond doesn't really have a stellar selection. And part of the problem is that there are basically two trim levels for an XC90. There's, or up until very, very recently anyway, there's the Momentum, which is the base level, and there's Inscription, which is the fancy level. And Aaron's car that is now totaled is a Momentum, but it's a Momentum that's been extremely well optioned. And so that means that we either need to pony up the bucks for the fancy model to get a lot of these options, not all of them, but a lot of them, or we need to find like a unicorn of a Momentum that has been just hilariously well optioned. And it turns out that's not gone well so far. So on Monday, we got back this past Sunday from the beach. On Monday, we went to Volvo of Richmond. We spoke to them in the sales department. Like this, they're okay. They're a lot better than they were 7 years ago when we said to them, "This is Aaron's car. It's for Erin." And the dirtbag salesperson never spoke to her and only spoke to me. And in retrospect, we should have walked out. And both of us agreed about this immediately after buying the car. But for whatever reason, I mean, we weren't that young, but we didn't, and we should have. And the person we spoke to this time was much better about that. And, you know, we were upfront with them. We were like, "Look, we had a real crappy experience 7 years ago, and we will walk if you're not going to treat her as the, you know, the not the queen, but you know what I'm saying? Like the star of the show here." Right. Exactly. Right. and the dude was super, super chill and super nice, but still very much a salesman. So they didn't really have any inventory we really liked. And what we're currently thinking, I'm sorry, I didn't make that clear. What we're currently thinking is, you know, replacing the XC90 with another XC90, which I could understand and argue that that's a dumb, terrible decision. But I really believe in my heart a few things, and we'll talk about why. But first of all, I really think that this is the best car for Erin. I really, really, really do. And number two, I don't know what the number two was. So we're just going to stick with that. Oh, that's what it was.
Do you think it's not going to die again from a pebble?
Exactly. I really think it was a, thank you. It was a one in a trillion bad, unlucky break. I really,
well,
really
we
do
know
think
it's not
that.
One in a trillion because somebody wrote in to say that this happened to two of their other Volvos. So I'm going to say it's
yeah, but they were wildly different generations.
Right. But let's say it's a 3 in a 9 billion chance.
Okay, fair enough.
I mean, it's still it definitely seems like it is not that rare. Like the fact that I believe we heard from multiple people who say something similar happened to them with a Volvo in particular. So it could be like a design flaw of some of their engines.
Not enough shielding on the bottom of the car or something.
Yeah,
like still like, super rare, I would imagine.
Yeah, but yeah. I think it might give me pause to own one out of warranty ever.
But yeah, it's whatever that effect is. Like if he had a Volkswagen and given the same story, we would have heard from the Volkswagen people who happened.
Yep.
So maybe this happens to 3 out of every 9 billion of every car manufacturer. It's difficult to draw conclusions from because it's not a random selection. It's self-selecting because we talked about Volvos. We hear from the Volvo people this happened to. Right. So I think the jury's still out on that.
So I assume, is there no chance of getting you into something electric here?
ATP.fm/join.
I know it's more money. It's also a lot nicer. It's also no gas. It also can't have that problem.
Harder to find with CarPlay sometimes.
That's very true.
Well,
I believe
there's something called the Volvo EX90.
Okay, so let's put that.
This is Polestar, and there's
Just hold on. Put that in the parking lot, for a second, and make sure I come back to that because there is an answer for that. But let me put that aside for a moment. So we look at the local Volvo dealer. What we're looking for is something around like a 2021 XC90. Aaron's car was not driven that much, so it only had like 42,000-43,000 miles on it. So we want something with fewer than 40,000 miles. And we want something that doesn't really give up any of the options we had before, which basically, if you speak Volvo, amounts to the climate package, which gives you like rear heated seats, which I think the kids are really going to want, even though we don't have winter here. And it gives you a few other things. I forget. Well, a heated wheel, which Aaron really, really liked. And the advanced package is, I think, what they call it, which, among other things, gives you a heads up display, which Aaron has become completely addicted to. And honestly, I would, too, if I were her. So to find that car has been challenging. Used is what we think we want to do. We could, potentially buy new, but we're talking, these cars are now $70,000 new. And I genuinely think they're great cars. I could even make an argument they're worth $70,000, but I don't particularly want to spend $70,000 on a car right this minute. So we didn't think that we really wanted to go that route. So, okay, that was Monday. Tuesday, I say to her, all right, let's go to the place I often mention on the show these days. Let's go to CarMax because CarMax is a used car retailer and they'll sell anything, right? And you can bounce between several different cars all in the same dealership and see and just sit in them, if not drive them, and see what you think. So four of us went to CarMax and we sat in and looked at an Atlas, a Volkswagen Atlas, a Audi Q7, which I actually really liked, but Aaron was not that keen on, a Kia Telluride, which is extraordinarily well-reviewed, and I know a couple people with them, and they love them, but Aaron didn't care for it. The Mazda CX-9, which was mostly because we had such good luck with her Mazda years ago, and that didn't impress either of us, and the Jeep Grand Cherokee, which I know you two are going to snicker, but honestly is a relatively upmarket three-row car that feels to me like it's 13 miles long, like suburban long.
Huge.
But
The current ones are huge. I don't know what year you were looking at.
We were looking at basically the brand new ones because we wanted the three.
Are they meaningfully bigger than the XC90?
I haven't looked it up, but I feel like they are. Exactly. It may not be bigger, but it looks bigger.
I bet
for
it's not.
Sure. It may not be. I genuinely don't know, and I'm not going to look it up while I'm talking, but it looks way bigger. And what was really great about the CarMax experience was we walked in, and there's a little like greeter person and they said, okay, what can I help you with? And I said, oh, I want to look at these cars. And of course, because it's me, I have model names and stock numbers written down. And the lady looks at it and says,
you're a
okay,
nightmare
well, this...
customer.
Oh, I am the worst. It gets worse because I had a different experience today. But she says, okay, this one's over there. That one's over there. That one's over there. That one's over there. Just, let us know if you have questions.
In other words, get out of my hair.
Well, but it was said with a smile. And so I'm like, what? Are they open? Like, do I need someone to go with me? And she said, no, they're all open. Just go to town. What? Really? Like, that's not how this usually works. And to be honest, I really enjoyed the CarMax experience because I didn't have to talk to anyone. And so it was really great. We just walked around. And granted, we're going through heat wave here, so it was like over 100 degrees. I want to say it's like 35 in stupid units. It's over 100 degrees. You know, it's 8 million percent humidity, and we're all drenched as we're looking at these cars. But, you know, you do what you do. And so we looked at them all, and the only one that was really in the running was Grand Cherokee, but not enough that she was like, yeah, I want to test drive that. It's huge. It's not really my cup of tea, but it's not my car. And if she was more enthusiastic about it, I definitely would have said, all right, let's go try it. But none of this really revved her engine. And they had a couple XC90s, but they weren't exactly what we wanted either. So I had my eyes on, and this is coming obliquely back to what you were talking about, Marco. I had my eyes on a T8 Volvo. So there's three different styles of Volvo in this generation. There's the T5, which was I believe it was turbocharged only instead of turbo and supercharged like Aaron's was. And it did not have a third row of seats. It just had, you know, empty space there. There's a T6, which Aaron had, which again, super and turbocharged. And then there's the T8, which depending on the generation or depending on the year, I should say, it was either the T6 with a small electric motor for the, I believe it was the rear wheels, or I think in later years, it was a turbocharged only motor with a slightly larger electric motor for the rear wheels. And what's great about this, what I find super appealing about this, is that you can, like some of these, you know, quasi hybrids, you can, well, it's a plug-in hybrid. I didn't specify that. But beyond that, you can go something like 20 miles pure electric. And part of the way that Aaron had a 7-year-old car that only had 40,000 miles on it is that most of the time we're driving, or she's driving, I should say, 5 miles, 10 miles, you know, maybe 20 in a day, maybe. And so on paper, well, first of all, on paper, a full electric car is the correct answer. I promise we're coming back to this, Marco. I promise.
All right.
But
by the way, apparently the EX90 is not actually out yet.
That's correct, yeah. And that's where I'm meandering.
You're
toward.
You're still talking about the XC90 here with the trim levels T8 and stuff, right?
That's correct. Yep.
Yeah, because it's still available now with a plug-in hybrid option for like, you know, 30 correct. Miles of range.
Exactly right. Exactly. And, you know, the new ones, the new plug-in hybrids are like $75,000, $80,000. It's just like, oh, whether or not we could afford that, which I don't know, but I don't think I want to pay that. You know, like even if we could afford it, I don't think I want to pay that kind of money. So anyways, Volvo of Fredericksburg. So this is on Interstate 95, pretty much dead on an hour north of us. They had a T8 that had, I think it's 30,000-ish miles and was optioned the way we want and looked like it was, I think they listed it for like $45,000, which was reasonable. I felt like it was a little more expensive than necessary, but reasonable. And I've been going back and forth with them over email, and they wouldn't come down to exactly the price we wanted. And I wanted to go see it because we had never driven a T8 before. So we went up there today. We drove it. All four of us jumped in the Volkswagen. We drove an hour north and we took it for a ride. And first of all, it wasn't in as quite as good condition as I like, and I know it's a used car. It's not going to be perfect. I don't expect it to be perfect. This is where I'm becoming a total pain in the butt client or customer. I know it won't be perfect, but we keep our cars really nice. And you know, this one had enough dings and dents and whatnot that it wasn't quite up to snuff. But the thing that was a real bummer, and if you work at a car dealership, take note of this for me, if for nothing else. This thing has a battery, right? It's a small battery, mm-hmm. but it's a battery nevertheless. And in order for this to really show us the differences between Aaron's T6 and the T8, that battery needs to be what? Charged. I'll give you one guess if that battery was charged when we took it out.
It's just like when I tried to drive the Wrangler plug-in hybrid.
I feel like the car dealerships are not equipped to keep all the plug-in hybrids plugged in. Like I'm assuming electric car dealerships are, because, you know, you kind of need that in the electric cars. But the hybrids are sold by, you know, gas car companies, and they're just mm-hmm. on the lot, in the parking spots. Yeah, that's a shame.
It's a total shame, because I went into this thinking, this is it. I had her old plates in my car. I had our insurance information for the old car. Like, I had a checkbook in the car. Like, I was ready to rock. And I didn't know if they were going to come down to the price we wanted. But leaving that aside, I thought, you know what? There's a better than 50% chance we will leave the house with two cars and return with, or excuse me, leave the house with one car, return with two cars. And we took it around the block, and Aaron keeps saying to me, this feels the same as my car. And it's not that I didn't believe her, but I was like, it should feel different, because in that application, it's her engine plus another like 70 horsepower or something like that from the pure electric motor. And so driving around in pure electric mode, it felt like a doggy, you know, a slower version of her car, which I think makes sense, you know, because it's not a strong electric motor. Real like battery electric cars like the Rivian are stupid fast. This is different than that, right? It's a little teeny electric motor, and it's enough to get you around town and do the sorts of things that Aaron needs to do, but it's not going to, you know, blow your hair back until you have the gasoline motor involved as well. And then this thing is like a 400 horsepower car or something like that. Now, granted, it weighs as much as a house, but Aaron's car, her old car, her now totaled car, that would keep up with my Golf R. Like, it was surprisingly quick. And in theory, I would have assumed this one would actually be faster than my car. And because the battery was freaking dead, it just really was not that impressive. And I went there thinking, she's going to like it and I'm going to friggin' love it, because I love fast SUVs. They're stupid, they're dumb, and they make zero sense, and I love them anyway.
Yeah, it feels like you're violating the laws of physics. Like, it's
right,
just,
that's
like,
what makes it so
why
fun.
Why is this thing so fast?
Right, exactly. So anyways, so we weren't impressed by that, and they had a couple other options. They were the least sleazy car salespeople I've ever worked with, so I really appreciated that. But we, you know, they let us drive away without anything. And I mean, I don't think there was much they could have done to put us in anything short of letting us effectively steal a car. But I have no answers. And so I asked both Richmond Volvo and Fredericksburg Volvo the same question. I asked them, okay, what's the story with the EX90? The EX90 is basically a full battery electric version of Aaron's car. I mean, there's differences here and there, but in spirit, it's a full battery electric version of Aaron's car. I'm still unconvinced that I want our workhorse to be a full battery electric vehicle, because we do long trips. And I don't.
You don't.
I'm sure. Well, so here's the thing. I'm optimizing for like 1 to 2 trips a year, which I intellectually know is dumb.
It's so
but
easy.
I haven't really gotten past that. And I recognize full on. I recognize that I'm kind of being an idiot about this.
You are.
But. Nevertheless, the EX90, both dealers independently said they are just rolling off the lines now. And I think the Richmond dealer said, I've never even seen one. And I believe the Fredericksburg dealer said, we've seen one, but we have no idea when we're getting them. It could be months. And I don't think that we have months to play with. And with regard to other battery electric vehicles, even leaving aside the fact that I'm not entirely convinced that's the right fit for us, the only other decent option is the Kia EV9, which I'm not sure I love the look of at all. And Erin is very not sold on an electric vehicle for her. I think both of us agree that my next car should be an electric car of some sort, but I don't think that it's time for Erin quite yet. So I don't really have any good answers with regard to a battery electric. And I mean, I would love to put her in an R1S. I really would. I would probably even hold my nose about CarPlay, but
you would. It's
certainly, certainly they are way more expensive than I want. And it doesn't look like there's a robust enough and or really what I should say is cheap enough used market to get to the price point that I'm looking to get to.
No, there isn't. Not yet.
And so all of that to say, I really thought today we were going to take care of business. It was going to get done. We were going to buy that T8. Life was going to be good. And now I don't know what to do, because there are enough used XC90s, broadly speaking, in the area, but none of them are really just the exactly what we want. And I'm not sure what to do. I don't particularly want to buy new, because it's way more money than we need to spend. And I'm not snooty enough that I need, or nor is she, that we need a new car. Like, we don't want or need to do that, but I'm having trouble finding that unicorn of something that I think is priced reasonably, not to say it's a steal, but reasonably, and not beat to hell, not with a trillion miles on it, and optioned the way we want. And so now I'm kind of like back at, you know, back at square one, and I genuinely don't know what we're going to do. The plan is still to go with an XC90 of some sort, but we might have to just wait it out for a while, or I don't know what we're going to do.
I mean, yeah, like the problem is like you're under time pressure, like that, like
exactly,
like there's really no, like when you have time pressure and you're really picky with a whole bunch of stuff.
Yep.
Like something has to give. Like you, and so you don't get to make the ideal choice. You have to compromise on something, or just get incredibly lucky with what you find. But that seems like that didn't happen. So, you know,
yeah.
The question is just which of these various things that you're gonna, you know, not be very happy about. Which compromise are you willing to take first?
Yeah, and that's the thing. And the only thing that is working on our side a little bit is that we're going away for a couple of weeks next month. And so we really need to make it like 3 more weeks, and then we disappear for 2, and then we can kind of reset and start over. So
yeah, but that means so your wife's going to have no car for 5 weeks. Like that's,
well, I mean,
much.
She could presumably rock the loaner from Volvo for some or all of that. And if they need it back, which we've told them many times, like, look, we're borrowing this kind of unfairly. Obviously, it's with their permission, but it's kind of unfair of us to expect this. So the moment you guys want this back, tell us, and we will have it back immediately. It's such a piece of trash. This car is so bad, but I don't think they're going to want it back anytime soon. But it's not a fair or appropriate for us to hold on to this for, you know, 2 months or whatever. So I genuinely don't know what we're going to do. I mean, maybe we rent a car for a couple of weeks to give us a little more time, but that's not cheap or free, you know, or anything like that. So yeah. I don't know. I'm genuinely at a loss of what
to
do.
Honestly, I think your best bet is, first of all, like, you have to also consider that Aaron's the customer, not you. And
yeah,
so,
no, that's fair.
And she, you know, she got this ridiculously bad luck thing happen. I think your best bet is to get her back into an XC90 in whatever form that needs to take. Like, I would stop looking at other vehicles that if that's the one she really likes and she really wants.
Oh yeah.
Figure out how to get an
XC90. Is her mind closed to non SUVs?
I think so. I mean, I will accept any kind of input, but we do use the capacity of the XC90 enough that I don't think she would do a sedan, and there are no sedans that exist in this country anyway.
And there in our Slack, a 2020 S60 plug-in hybrid for $35,000.
I mean, that looks like a nice car, but that's a much smaller total cargo volume, though.
Exactly.
All right.
Well,
you got 2 small children. They would fit in this car. It's really nice. It's a plug-in hybrid.
Well, and it's funny, too, because
40,000 miles, 47,000.
So one of the – well, that's more than I want. But anyways one of the things we talked about, because we ended up having to rent a minivan to get to the beach and back, right? And I got to admit, this Chrysler Pacifica, which actually, by the way, was delivered to us from Enterprise Rental with 36 miles on it. It just so happened we were the first people to rent it. And I don't want to own a minivan for a few reasons, but I will be the first to tell you, and she would agree, on paper, that is 100% the correct answer.
Honestly,
there's a lot.
Everyone I've ever heard from who owns a minivan, they all say they're amazing. Like, you just have to get over the fact that you own a minivan. But, like, once you get over that, people love them. Like, they are really good in a lot of ways. And if what you're looking for is a large amount of passenger and cargo volume and have it be roughly, you know, that kind of size and shape, you know, higher seating position, big volume, like, fits a bunch of kids stuff, like, there's a reason minivans are so popular and have been for so long. They're incredibly, like, practical, and people generally love them who have them.
And actually, come to think of it, well, first of all, yes to everything you just said. Second of all, when we go on these beach trips, and it's getting better and better with each year as the kids get bigger and require less stuff and whatever, but we take Penny with us, and so that's a little bit of added cargo in and of itself. But when we go on these beach trips, we typically will put a Thule or whatever you call it, you know, one of those cargo carriers on the roof of Aaron's car, and we still fill this thing just freaking
what are
full.
You bringing on your vacation?
That's a lot.
With your two small children, you have the giant car, and you need to have a roof thing.
Yeah, John, we do this every year. I don't have time for it right now.
Are you bringing like a gas grill with
can
you?
Can we push on this a little bit? Like, because
we can come back to
excessive.
This. We can come back to this if you want. But suffice to say, we have a Thule or however you pronounce it, and the car is chock full. Right. Well, this minivan, I am freaking out because it doesn't have any roof rails or anything like that. I am telling Erin, I say to her, there's no freaking way we're going to fit everything. We're going to have to cut some stuff. And she was like, first of all, we'll fit everything. Second of all, if we can't, we'll just leave some stuff behind. It'll be fine.
Yeah, I think it sounds like you might benefit from cutting some stuff.
Well, okay, there is that. But nevertheless, we start packing the minivan, and it turns out that under the middle row, like under the floorboard in the middle row, there's these like freaking cavernous gullies. I genuinely don't know if this minivan was all-wheel drive or not. I want to say it wasn't, but either way, there's these cavernous gullies under the kids' seats, or under their feet, I should say. And we filled those with a bunch of stuff. Then the back, it was like two-thirds full. It was amazing. It was amazing how cavernous this thing was. It was incredible. And it also had wireless CarPlay, which we only used briefly, but actually, and this is a Chrysler, mind you, which I don't personally consider a terribly fancy brand, even though I think they might think they are. But anyways, the wireless CarPlay was very good, like very low latency. The screen was very high resolution compared to either of our cars. It looked like retina. I mean, it wasn't literally, but it looked that way. It was very impressive. But anyway, so we, you know, we rented this minivan for the beach, and that worked out really nicely. And we talked about, should we get a minivan, or alternatively, should we get a sedan and then just understand we're going to rent minivans to go to the beach every year? And what we concluded was we do use that space in the XC90 often enough to justify something large. But I mean, John, your question is not unreasonable. It really, really, really isn't. But I think ultimately, to come back to what Marco was saying, she had this thing that she loved ripped away from her by incredibly crummy luck. It's not like she got in an accident that was her fault or something like that. She didn't get in an accident at all by any reasonable definition. It's just she had catastrophic engine failure. And so I think I'm pretty convinced, and I think she is too, that an XC90 is the right answer. So we are no longer cross-shopping. I forget which one of you was asking that question, but we're no longer cross-shopping. We did it just so we could check it off the list. We're not going to do that anymore. But the question I keep asking myself is, I do not want to spend new car money on a new car for her, or for anyone, really. It's not her specifically. But the more I think about it, the more I'm wondering if maybe I just need to bite the bullet and find her the exact car that she wants. Because A, she freaking deserves it. She's named
that. That is the correct answer.
And B, if I can't put my fingers on, if I can't put my hands on a used one that she really, really likes, then why wouldn't we get a new one? Now, I think I'm more on board with this idea than she is. She is unquestionably the more frugal of the two of us, or more financially responsible of the two of us. So I think it might, even if I'm convinced, I don't know if I could convince her, but it's where I'm starting to lean at this point, because I just can't find exactly what we want.
Chat is pointing. If you want to soften the burden a little bit up front, like leasing could be an option. And I would also, you know, caution you that, like, I would maybe not want to own a Volvo outside of warranty, and leasing fixes that problem as well.
I'm kind of allergic to leasing, but what I haven't mentioned is both the dealers told us, and I don't remember the specific incentive, but I don't know if it's like a government thing or a Volvo thing, but apparently if you lease, they're offering like $7,500 off right now or something like that, like an absurd amount of money.
$7,500 is the EV tax credit thing, isn't it?
See, that's what I thought, but I don't know how that would apply to these cars unless it's
maybe they're just matching the government thing.
That could be. It could be.
Automakers use lease incentives all the time to like boost their quarterly numbers. So like take advantage. Like you very frequently in the auto business, a lease special is often like the best deal on a new car that's available anywhere. Like because they do kind of bet against their own future selves to boost the short term gain. As a customer, like if what you want is available with a heavily discounted lease special, That's often worth considering.
Yeah, and so even though I find leases to be how do you pronounce the word, anathema? Is that right? Is that what I'm looking for? I find it disgusting to lease. Like it's not my jam. But I shouldn't say disgusting. It's just not for me. But that being said, if you're offering me $7,500 off, I'll carry a lease for at least a few months until I can pay it off or whatever the case may be.
That's not how that works.
According to Volvo, they said you just got to lease it and last like 3 months or something like that, and then you can buy yourself out of it or whatever. I've never leased before, so I'd have to talk to them more about it if we get serious. But either way, it it's between that and I think most Volvo dealers or maybe Volvo corporate offers like a, you know, oh, you've previously owned a Volvo, we'll give you $1,000 to buy another one. Then we're Costco members, and Costco, which is a big box store here in the United States, they do like negotiations with these different car manufacturers. And so I think we get $1,000 off from that. So suddenly we're looking at like $9,500 off potentially on a brand new Volvo. And suddenly the $70,000 Volvo is $60,000, which is quite a bit more than I wanted to spend still. But nevertheless, it at least makes this sort of thing approachable or a possibility.
Can I convince you to use the $10,000 savings to get the plug-in hybrid version at least?
Well, and honestly, I think I would really, really, really consider it. Because again, leaving aside the fact that it makes the car kind of fast, what I cannot stress enough is how appealing it is to me that we could have, even though I don't really love plug-in hybrids in general, I think in this application, it actually is exactly the right answer, because we have the infinite range asterisk dagger, double dagger for when we go on whatever trip we need to go on. But for all the around town piddly stuff, she can just go pure electric and it'd be fine.
Plug-in hybrids are very popular for good reason. Like they are extremely compatible with current American usage and priorities and fears. Like they're very compatible with that. Like people want to dip their toe in electric. They think for those two trips a year that you take that somehow it's never going to be possible to charge an electric car on the highway. So they think they need gas. So this is a way for you to try out electric, realize that you like it better, and then for the next vehicle after this that your family purchases, you'll go actual electric. But that's the correct step now is to take the plug-in hybrid now and begin that transition in a comfortable way that won't push anybody outside their comfort zone.
Now, the problem with the hybrids is they got twice as much crap to go wrong. Like, and historically speaking, the reliability of hybrids has not been as good as internal combustion or EVs. They're better now. The newer designs have less stuff in them, but there's no getting around the fact that there's more stuff than in an EV, and there's more stuff than an internal combustion engine, because it's got both. Maybe not a concern. Obviously, you know, if you're not going to own the car that long, you probably don't care, and it'll probably be fine, but do keep that in mind.
Yeah, it's something worth, but also keep in mind that for all those electric-only local miles, that serpentine belt is not going to be turning.
Well, it depends on the hybrid drivetrains are very different from manufacturer to manufacturer, and that's not necessarily the case. So I don't know where the belt is, where the engine is facing on these hybrids. Like, there's so many potential options of how to do hybrid drives, and many of them are very different than the internal combustion engines in the same model. So you can look into that. But honestly, I just think that maybe the goal is just to keep the pebbles out. Like, whatever's going on with the belts, maybe don't want the pebbles in.
Yeah, well, we'll work on that for next time. But no, this is a not a longitudinal. It's a, what's the opposite of that? A sideways mount. What's the word I'm looking for? The engine's mounted like your cars are.
Transverse?
Thank you. Yes, that's what
versus
I was looking
longitudinal.
For. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a transverse mounted engine, so the belt is on the passenger side on an American car. But yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens. It's just tough because, you know, we try to be financially prudent. We try to have an oh crap fund, like I think any reasonable adult should at least try to do. But there are not a lot of people who have a $70,000 oh crap fund, you know what I mean? And so it's just obviously, you know, we're not going to pay cash for this, but it's just still, it's like, oh, that's so much money that I was not planning on spending. And so that's just
consider
tough.
The insurance is giving you a hefty discount.
Right. Exactly.
And so we're all these various incentives and everything. And, you know, owning a car is always a massive money hole. There's no way to own a car that you don't lose money. It's just a question of when you lose the money, and sometimes it's not within your control, sometimes it is. So it's just when and how this money gets burned. So it's, you know, this was obviously, you couldn't have planned for this, but you are car owners and you like giant, nice cars. And so, like, this is, you're going to burn this money at some point. Yep. You just have to do it, you know, at a time that you weren't necessarily expecting.
Yep, exactly right. All right, titles.
Let's see.
Not a lot.
No. I do like Shoved There by the Phone. Not a European Lawyer is good. Let's see. If Europe was filled with Texans. That is really good.
I don't think we want that'll, to anger that'll offend. I don't think we want to anger the Europeans or the Texans with that.
Right,
one.
Exactly right. I was going to say that would offend both the Europeans and the Texans.
Yeah, it should.
The Texans like their guns too much. Cheeses in Italy is so freaking random, but that's very good.
It's
charged twice
be.
As much for milk. I like Sage for me has done a very good job, although it's like four people that have contributed today.
The chat was not working, or at least maybe the web chat.
Maybe
the web chat didn't work. I don't know. That's some just weird embed that I think Freenode or whoever we're on now.
It goes down sometimes, but then it comes back.
Yeah. Anyway, let's see.
I like cheeses in Italy. What else?
Not a European lawyer, I like.
Yeah. I like European lawyer, shoved there, and Texans.
Of those, I would probably take shoved there, but I wouldn't veto the European lawyer. It's not as fun to me.
I think not the European lawyer is the one with the most consensus.
All right.
Designed by committee. The one that we all think is okay. That
one. Sure words, never spoken.
All right. We'll do overtime now. We're going to cut off the live broadcast. Thank you, live people, for being live people, and we will talk to you next week.